This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers. Read by Stephen Hoy. Chapter 1. Sacred Ground. The only thing new in the world is the history you don't know. Harry Truman. In the spring of 1998, six boys called to me from half a century ago on a distant mountain, and I went there. For a few days, I set aside my comfortable life, my business concerns, my life in Rye, New York, and made a pilgrimage to the other side of the world, to a primitive flyspeck island in the Pacific. There, waiting for me, was the mountain the boys had climbed in the midst of a terrible battle half a century earlier. One of them was my father. The mountain was called Suribachi. The island, Iwo Jima. The fate of the late 20th and 21st centuries was being forged in blood on that island and others like it. The combatants on either side were kids. Kids who had mostly come of age in cultures that resembled those of the 19th century. My young father and his five comrades were typical of these kids. Tired, scared, thirsty, brave. Tiny integers in the vast confusion of war-making, trying to do their duty, trying to survive. But something unusual happened to these six. History turned all its focus for 1/400th of a second on them. It froze them in an elegant instant of battle, froze them in a camera lens as they hoisted an American flag on a makeshift pole. Their collective image, blurred and indistinct yet unforgettable, became the most recognized, the most reproduced in the history of photography. It gave them a kind of immortality, a faceless immortality. The flag raising on Iwo Jima became a symbol of the island, the mountain, the battle, of World War II, of the highest ideals of the nation, of valor incarnate. It became everything except the salvation of the boys who formed it. For these six, history had a different set of agendas. Three were killed in action in the continuing battle. Of the three survivors, two were overtaken and eventually destroyed, dead of drink and heartbreak. Only one of them managed to live in peace into an advanced age. He achieved this peace by willing the past into a cave of silence. My father, John Henry Bradley, returned home to small-town Wisconsin after the war. He shoved the mementos of his immortality into a few cardboard boxes and hid these in a closet. He married his third-grade sweetheart. He opened a funeral home, fathered eight children, joined the PTA, the Lions, the Elks, and shut out any conversation on the topic of raising the flag on Iwo Jima. When he died in January 1994, in the town of his birth, he might have believed he was taking the unwanted story of his part in the flag-raising with him to the grave, where he apparently felt it belonged. He had trained us, as children, to deflect the phone call requests for media interviews that never diminished over the years. We were to tell the caller that our father was on a fishing trip. But John Bradley never fished. No copy of the famous photograph hung in our house. When we did manage to extract from him a remark about the incident, his responses were short and simple, and he quickly changed the subject. And this is how we Bradley children grew up. Happily enough, deeply connected to our peaceful, tree-shaded town, but always with a sense of an unsolved mystery somewhere at the edges of the picture. We sensed that the outside world knew something important about him that we would never know. For him, it was a dead issue, a boring topic, but not for the rest of us. Me, especially. For me, a middle child among the eight, the mystery was tantalizing. I knew from an early age that my father had been some sort of hero. My third-grade schoolteacher said so. Everybody said so. I hungered to know the heroic part of my dad. But try as I might, I could never get him to tell me about it. "The real heroes of Iwo Jima," he said once, coming as close as he ever would, "are the guys who didn't come back." John Bradley might have succeeded in taking his story to his grave had we not stumbled upon the cardboard boxes a few days after his death. My mother and brothers Mark and Patrick were searching for my father's will in the apartment he had maintained as his private office. In a dark closet, they discovered three heavy cardboard boxes, old but in good shape, stacked on top of each other. In those boxes, my father had saved the many photos and documents that came his way as a flag raiser. All of us were surprised that he had saved anything at all. Later, I rummaged through the boxes. One letter caught my eye. The cancellation indicated it was mailed from Iwo Jima on February 26, 1945, a letter written by my father to his folks just 3 days after the flag raising. The carefree, reassuring style of his sentences offers no hint of the hell he had just been through. He managed to sound as though he were on a rugged but enjoyable Boy Scout hike. "I'd give my left arm for a good shower and a clean shave. I have a 6-day beard. Haven't had any soap or water since I hit the beach. I never knew I could go without food, water, or sleep for 3 days, but I know now it can be done." And then, almost as an aside, he wrote, "You know all about our battle out here. I was with the victorious Easy Company, who reached the top of Mount Suribachi first. I had a little to do with raising the American flag, and it was the happiest moment of my life." The happiest moment of his life. What a shock to read that. I wept as I realized the flag raising had been a happy moment for him as a 21-year-old. What happened in the intervening years to cause his silence? Reading my father's letter made the flag-raising photo somehow come alive in my imagination. Over the next few weeks, I found myself staring at the photo on my office wall, daydreaming. Who were those boys with their hands on that pole, I wondered. Were they like my father? Had they known one another before that moment, or were they strangers, united by a common duty? Did they joke with one another? Did they have nicknames? Was the flag raising the happiest moment of each of their lives? The quest to answer those questions consumed 4 years. At its outset, I could not have told you if there were 5 or 6 flag raisers in that photograph. Certainly, I did not know the names of the three who died during the battle. By its conclusion, I knew each of them like I know my brothers, like I know my high school chums, and I had grown to love them. What I discovered on that quest forms the content of this book. The quest ended symbolically with my own pilgrimage to Iwo Jima. Accompanied by my 74-year-old mother, 3 of my brothers, and many military men and women, I ascended the 550-foot volcanic crater that was Mount Suribachi. My 21-year-old father had made the climb on foot carrying bandages and medical supplies. Our party was whisked up in Marine Corps van. I stood at its summit in a whipping wind that helped dry my tears. This was exactly where that American flag was raised, on a February afternoon 53 years before. The wind had whipped on that day as well. It had straightened the rippling fabric of that flag by its force. Chapter 7. D-Day. Life was never regular again. We were changed from the day we put our feet in that sand. Private Tech Stanton, 2nd Platoon, Easy Company. It began eerily in the night. A dark Pacific sky cut by hellish red comets, rising and descending in clusters of 3, each descent followed by a distant explosion. Sleepless young Marines stood watching atop their LSTs, 13 miles offshore. To Easy Company's Robert Leader of Cambridge, Massachusetts, it looked like heat lightning on a summer night. Through his days, he heard a voice in the darkness utter what sounded like a fragment from a dream. "That's Sulphur Island." "What do you mean?" Leader murmured, not turning his eyes from the sky. The speaker beside him, a Navy crewman, replied, "Don't you know? Iwo Jima means Sulphur Island." The sun rose pink. The sky turned blue and clear. On the horizon, the Sulphur Island lay wreathed in smoke. The date was February 19th, 1945. The cooks on the transport ships had provided a gourmet breakfast for the young men about to suffer and die. Steak and eggs. Doc awoke with the others before dawn. The first words spoken to him were from a veteran. Me, I'm experienced enough to dodge the bullets. You? Well, you'll probably get one right between the eyes. Mike had spent much of the night watching the shelling. Ed Blankenberger, who stood beside him, had been elated. Surely this barrage would all but obliterate the enemy. His optimism was shared by many of the boys. 17-year-old Donald Howell from Mercer City, Ohio, was so certain there would be no Japanese survivors that he relaxed on board with a book called House Madam about brothels on the West Coast. And so Blankenberger was surprised when near dawn he heard Mike say quietly, "I'm not coming back from this one, Ed." Over 70,000 Marines, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th Divisions massed in the ships that had finally arrived at Island X, ready to hit the narrow 2-mile beach in successive phases. Awaiting them, dug into the island and out of sight, 22,000 elite Japanese, the rising sun, who understood that they were to die. At 7 a.m., the boys of Easy Company walked down the metal steps of LST 481 and into the yawing holds of their assigned amphibious tractors. All the terrifying practice that Doc Bradley had put in scrambling down those treacherous net ladders in Hawaii had gone for naught. But there was plenty of terror left. "I was petrified when we got into those Amtraks," Corpsman Vernon Parrish, a close friend of Doc's, recalled. "I was new to battle, but I could sense that even the veterans were scared." Parrish's fears were hardly calmed when one veteran, gazing at Iwu, said out of the corner of his mouth, "You don't know what's going to happen. You're going to learn more in the first 5 minutes there than you did in the whole year of training you've been through." Now the first waves of tractors were loaded and surging toward the island at full throttle, kicking up white foam behind them, their turbine engines deafening to the helmeted young men packed inside, about 20 to a boat. Behind and above them was an overwhelming American force that controlled the sea and the air. In the sea, the armada at anchor, vessels stretching away from shore for 10 miles. In the air, flights of Navy Hellcats swooping low to strafe Mount Suribachi, reshaping its contours with their firepower. In front of them lay the most ingenious and deadly fortress in military history. The century of the Pacific was about to be forged in blood. In those final moments before the first landing, many of the troops in the boats could still convince themselves that this was going to be no sweat. They could do this despite the evidence to the contrary around them. The doctors and medics with their surgical instruments and their operating tables ready to be set up on the beaches, the rabbis, priests, and ministers in their midst prepared to wade ashore and risk their lives to comfort the dying, and the wooden crosses, the Stars of David, the body bags that later boats would carry. Maybe all that stuff would not be needed. Wasn't the island being blown to bits even as the Amtraks churned toward shore? The enormous battle wagons out in the ocean were blasting Iwo Jima with sheets of one-ton shells. The concussion of these great guns nearly capsized some of the smaller boats. Howland Mad Smith himself would remember it as a barrage that blotted out all light like a hurricane eclipse of the sun. In those final moments, a carefree kid aboard Doc's Amtrak could still serenade his buddies with Nelson Eddy, Jeanette McDonald movie tunes. In those final moments, 18-year-old Jim Buchanan of Portland, Oregon, could still view the bombing as a beautiful tableau, like in a movie. The island nearly invisible beneath clouds of gray, yellow, and white dust from all the rockets and bombs. He turned to his buddy, a kid named Scotty, and asked hopefully, "Do you think there will be any Japanese left for us?" Jim Buchanan could not possibly fathom what lay immediately ahead. None of them could. The bombardment had not touched the subterranean Isengorin. They would have to be obliterated individually, up close, at tremendous cost. The Marines were hurtling toward a mutual slaughter that would involve nearly 120,000 Japanese and Americans on and offshore, consume 36 days, kill or maim more than half the land combatants, and assume characteristics unlike anything in 20th century warfare. The Battle of Iwo Jima would quickly turn into a primitive contest of gladiators. Japanese gladiators fighting from caves and tunnels like the catacombs of the Colosseum, and American gladiators above ground, exposed on all sides, using liquid gasoline to burn their opponents out of their lethal hiding places. All of this on an island 5.5 miles long and 2 miles wide, an area smaller than Doc Bradley's hometown of Antigo, but bearing 10 times the humanity. A car driving 60 miles an hour could cover its length in 5.5 minutes. For the slogging, fighting, dying Marines, it would take more than a month. The naval bombardment lifted precisely at 8:57 a.m. At 9:02, just 120 seconds behind a schedule that had kicked in at Hawaii, the first wave, armored tractors, each mounted with a 75-millimeter cannon, lumbered from the waves onto the soft black sands of Iwo Jima. The first troop carrying Amtraks landed 3 minutes later at 9:05 a.m., and behind them came hundreds more, each trailing a white wake. Easy Company rolled in on the 12th wave at 9:55 a.m. Easy was part of Harry the Horse's 28th Regiment, whose special mission was to land on Green Beach 1, the stretch nearest Mount Suribachi, just 400 yards away on the left, and then form a ribbon of men across the narrow neck of the island, isolating the fortified mountain and ultimately capturing it. This assignment meant that Easy Company would be part of a 2,000-man force fighting a separate battle from the main assault. Some of the 5th and the entire 4th Division would fan out toward the right and progress northward along the island's length to engage the bulk of its defenders. Before the battle ended, part of the 3rd Division, originally seen as a reserve force, would be rushed into action. The 28th's was no small mission. As Howland Mad Smith would later declare, "The success of our entire assault depended upon the early capture of that grim, smoking rock." And so the great tragic funneling from wide ocean to narrow beach had begun. Hordes of wet, equipment-burdened boys slogging from the water, forming a tightly packed mass on the 2 mile strip of beach, targets in a shooting gallery. The boys squinted upward at their assigned routes and the ugly, stunted mountain beyond. The beach slanted upward from a point some 30 yards from the edge of the surf. It rose in 3 terraces, each about 8 feet high and 16 feet apart. In peaceful times, it might have resembled a gently curving amphitheater. In this context, it was an amphitheater of death. The boys would have to climb not on hard white sand, but on soft black volcanic ash that gave way and made each upward step a lingering effort. The first wave of Marines and armored vehicles hit the shores. The vehicles bogged down immediately in the absorbent maw. The troops moved around them and began their cautious climb, unshielded up the terraces. It was all so quiet at first. Perhaps the optimistic young Marines had been right. Perhaps it was over already. Donald Howell recalled, "When the landing gate dropped, I just walked onto the beach. I was confident. Everyone was milling around. I thought this would be a cinch." The cinch lasted about an hour. The false calm was part of General Kurabashi's radical strategy to hold off from firing at once, as every other Japanese force had done in the island campaign, and wait until the funneling attackers had filled the beach. Easy Company had been ashore some 20 minutes and in their assembly area when the slaughter began. Smoke, an ear-splitting noise, suddenly filled the universe. The almost unnoticed blockhouses on the flat ground facing the ocean began raking the exposed troops with machine gun bullets, but the real firestorm erupted from the mountain, from Suribachi. Mortars, heavy artillery shells, and machine gun rounds ripped into the stunned Americans. 2,000 hidden Japanese were gunning them down, with everything from rifles to coastal defense guns. "It was so loud, it was almost like it was quiet," one stunned Marine remembered. To Lieutenant Keith Wells, Doc's 3rd platoon leader, Suribachi turned into a monstrous Christmas tree with blinking lights. The lights were gun barrels discharging ammunition at him and his men. There was no protection. Now the mortars and bullets were tearing in from all over the island. General Kurobayashi had designed an elaborate crossfire from other units to the north. Entire platoons were engulfed in fireballs. Boys clawed frantically at the soft ash, trying to dig holes, but the ash filled in each swipe of the hand or shovel. Heavy rounds sent jeeps and armored tractors spinning into the air in fragments. Some Marines hit by these rounds were not just killed. Their bodies ceased to exist. More than Marines. I was watching an Amtrak to the side of us as we went in, Robert Leder remembers. Then there was this enormous blast and it disappeared. I looked for wreckage and survivors, but nothing. I couldn't believe it. Everything just vaporized. In the same boat with Leder was Doc Bradley. The boys on the beach scrambled forward. It was like walking through a pile of shell corn, said one. Like climbing in talcum powder, said another. Like a bin of wheat, like deep snow. Advancing tanks crushed those of the wounded who could not get out of the way. Others, unwounded, were shoved to their deaths by those behind them. More and more boats kept landing with more guys coming onto the beach, said Guy Castorini. You had to just push the guy in front of you. It was like pushing him to his death. The shock of actual combat triggered bizarre thoughts and behavior. Some Marines dropped into a deep, terror-induced sleep amid the carnage and had to be kicked awake by their officers. Others clung to fastidious habits of civilian life. I don't smoke, moaned a badly wounded boy who'd been offered a lit cigarette. Jim Buchanan, who had hoped there would be some Japanese left for him, became indignant when he realized what was happening. Did you see those Japanese firing at us? He screamed to the guy next to him. No, the leatherneck answered, deadpan. Did you shoot them? Gee, no, Buchanan replied. That didn't occur to me. I've never been shot at before. Phil Ward, leaping out of the Amtrak that also contained my father, had a similar epiphany. We'd had live ammo training in Hawaii, so I was used to the sound of bullets, but suddenly I realized why this was different. God damn, I said. These people are shooting at me. The beach rapidly turned into a salvage yard of wrecked trucks and jeeps stuck in the sand or smashed by artillery. The dead piled up along the shoreline. Coming in, I could see the guys lying on the beach, Corman Roy Steinfort recalled. I thought, great, they'll cover our landing. But when we drew closer, I saw they were all dead. Annihilation seemed possible in the hideous first minutes. Radio transmissions back to command quarters aboard the ships raised that specter. Catching all hell from the quarry, heavy mortar and machine gun fire, taking heavy casualties and can't move for the moment. Mortars killing us. All units pinned down by artillery and mortars. Casualties heavy. Need tank support fast to move anywhere. Taking heavy fire and forward movement stopped. Machine gun and artillery fire heaviest ever seen. But it was even worse than what the transmissions indicated. No one was out of danger. A 5'3" Associated Press photographer named Joe Rosenthal, landing with the 4th Division, ran for his life through the hail of bullets. Later he would declare that not getting hit was like running through rain and not getting wet. Corpsman Greg Emery, crawling on all fours, glanced back at a landing craft coming in. The ramp dropped down. Machine gun fire ripped the interior. Boys fell dead atop each other as they stumbled off the ramp. The first wave of Easy Company Marines caught on the terraces in their heavy packs scrambled for survival. Like climbing a waterfall, one remembered. Jerry Smith pressed himself as close to the ground as he could and felt bullets rip through his backpack. Even the socks in my pack had bullet holes in them, he recalls. The volcanic ash slowed progress and kept the Marines exposed to fire, but in another sense the ash saved lives. It absorbed many of the mortar rounds and shrapnel, muffling explosions and sucking in the lethal fragments. Lieutenant Ed Pinnell's 2nd Platoon nearly lost its way in these early moments of deafening chaos. The unit, with Mike as squad leader and Harlan, Franklin, and Ira in the ranks, landed far off course, north of Green Beach. Shortly after the bombardment erupted, Harry the Horse summoned Easy Company Captain Dave Severance and ordered him to stand by. Are you ready to move out? Liversedge demanded. All except the 2nd Platoon that hasn't arrived yet, sir, Severance replied. Well, you've got 5 minutes to find that platoon or you're up for a general court-martial, the colonel retorted. The platoon soon rejoined the company. Its wayward landing down the beach had touched off a comic moment before the carnage. Lieutenant Pennell had thought to reorient his men with a show of John Wayne-like gallantry. As the Amtrak's ramp went down, he yelled, "Come on, men!" and then fell flat on his face into the water-saturated volcanic ash. "The guys ran up my back laughing," he remembered. Not everyone was laughing. "I was a very scared son of a gun," Ira wrote later. "Our boat hit solid ground and the ramp went down. I jumped clear of the ramp. About 3 yards away lay a dead Marine right on the water's edge, shot in the head. He hadn't begun to fight. My stomach turned flip-flops and I started to get scared all over again." A tissue of their former lives connected many of the onrushing warriors. Ironies, coincidences of place and memory, overlapping fragments of their boyhoods. Wesley Kuhn of Black Creek, Wisconsin, was 19 years old when he hit the beach. Wesley did not know Doc Bradley, who could not have been more than a few dozen yards away, but he knew Doc's future wife, Betty Van Gorp. Wesley and Betty had been in a school play together in the 9th grade. Wesley's role had been that of the kissing bandit, who'd snuck up and planted a kiss on Betty, who was playing an innocent housewife. "Bodies, body parts, everywhere he looked," recalled Kuhn. "My worst memory is of the first time I saw a man with his chest blown open and dirt trickling in on his vital organs." There were moments of grotesque humor. Monroe Osment of Virginia and his buddies were struggling up and over the third terrace, getting picked off by machine gun and mortar fire when someone yelled, "Turner got hit!" "Turner was a heavyset guy," Osment remembered, "and we always kidded him that if he got hit, he'd get it in the butt. Where'd he get hit?" I shouted, and someone yelled back, "In the butt!" But there were many more moments of unbearable pathos. 19-year-old corpsman Danny Thomas hit the beach at 10:15 a.m., several paces behind his best buddy, Chick Harris. In training camp, Thomas and Harris were called the Buttermilk Boys because they were too young to buy drinks on Liberty. "I was charging ahead and saw Chick on the beach, facing out to sea, his back to the battle," Thomas recalled. His buddy was in a strange posture. His head and torso were erect, as though he'd let himself be buried in the sand from the waist down in some bizarre prank. As Thomas rushed past him, he yelled a greeting and saw Chick's hand and eyes move, acknowledging him. Then Thomas glimpsed something else that made him fall to his knees in the sand, vomiting. The something else was blood and entrails. "I vomited my toenails out," Thomas remembered. "I realized that Chick had been cut in two. The lower half of his body was gone." He added, "He was the first person I ever saw dead. Buttermilk Chick was 15. He had lied about his age to get into the Marines." The big shells had blown a few holes in the ash. Guy Castorini and a few other rookies were in one behind their leader, a veteran named Lunsford. "We had no idea if this was a bad battle or not." One of the guys yelled, "Hey, Lunsford, is this a bad battle?" Lunsford shouted back, "It's a fucking slaughter!" Maybe 2 minutes later, whoom, we got hit with a mortar. I ducked and something dropped on my back and rolled off. It felt like a coconut or something. I looked down and saw that it was Lunsford's head. Those were his last words. A fucking slaughter. Somehow the Marines kept advancing. Somehow discipline held. Somehow valor overcame terror. Somehow scared young men under sheets of deadly fire kept on doing the basic gritty tasks necessary to keep the invasion going. The calming presence of veterans in their midst was one factor in their resolve. Another was their year of advanced Marine training in the California and Hawaii camps. "Our training taught us how to conquer fear," was the way Corpsman Langley put it. "We knew there was a good possibility that we would die or get wounded, but we knew we had to keep going to keep from getting killed. You learn there's an awful lot you can do while having the hell scared out of you." Mike Strank, true to form, was one of the steadying veterans. In the opening moments of Japanese mortar fire, when the boys of Easy Company were still groping their way toward Captain Severance's main unit, Lloyd Thompson looked up to his right and could not believe what he saw. There was Mike, sitting upright, emptying the sand out of his boots, just as if nothing was happening. Bill Rannis remembers the same sight. I had my face buried in the sand. I looked up and saw Mike sitting straight up, emptying his shoes. What a guy. Having made his point, Mike was soon shepherding his boys across the sands to their rendezvous with Dave Severance's unit. Joe Rodriguez remembers him dashing back and forth among his squad members, cautioning them to spread out. Don't bunch up. Don't be like a bunch of bananas. It was gestures such as Mike's, probably hundreds of them, most lost to history, that enabled the Americans to withstand the maelstrom of hidden firepower and even to begin inflicting damage of their own. Damage against what? That was the constant question at Iwo Jima. There were no targets. The gunners were invisible, protected, creatures of the underworld. Sergeant Major Lindolph Ward summed up the frustration. The thing that bothered me was you couldn't get your licks in. There was no visible enemy to shoot at. Even when they claimed a casualty, the Marines could rarely see it. The Japanese quickly pulled their dead and wounded back inside the caves and blockhouses. Thus, there was little evidence of the invasion's impact, a detriment to morale. In the days that followed, observers of the battle in spotter planes high above the action would remark that it looked as though the Marines were fighting the island itself. And yet the Americans did inflict damage that hellish first morning by the same excruciating means they would continue to inflict it for 36 days until all the 22,000 defenders were wiped out. By exposing themselves to fire, charging the fortified blockhouses and cave entrances, and shooting or incinerating their tormentors at close range. One of their strategies was to identify fire lanes. By observing where enemy machine gun bullets were landing and kicking up ash, a Marine could roughly judge the peripheral limits of a shooter's range, his capacity to swivel the gun left and right from inside his cave or blockhouse. Units of boys, widely spaced, would dash along the outer boundaries of those fire lanes, a great many of them falling dead or wounded under crossfire, until a survivor reached the cave's mouth or the blockhouse's unprotected rear, then a tossed grenade, an orange sheet from a flamethrower, and the nest was silent. For a while. An early mistake in the invasion was to assume that a source of enemy fire once extinguished was permanently dead. It wasn't. General Kurabayashi's vast tunneling system assured that many Marines were shot as they moved past a neutralized nest that had been quickly repopulated from below the ground. Throughout the bloody morning, fresh troops landed on the beaches. Tangible progress was achieved in the opening hour and a half of combat. By 10:35 a.m., a small group of men from the first assault waves, Company A of the 28th Regiment, had survived a near-suicidal 700-yard dash across the island to the western beach. Already Suribachi was cut off from the rest of the island. The reptile's head was alive and deadly, but it had been severed. How they got there was a portrait of American victory in microcosm. They got there with courage best exemplified by Tony Stein's headlong charge. Stein was a 23-year-old corporal from Dayton who became the first Medal of Honor winner on Iwo. For the risky mission, he'd armed himself with a Stinger gun, a light machine gun he'd taken from an airplane, and adapted into a rapid-fire gun. When his comrades were stalled on their dash by concentrated Japanese fire, Stein stood upright, drawing the enemy's fire and allowing his buddies to get into position. But Stein was just getting warmed up. His next move was to charge the nearby Japanese pillboxes alone. He did this several times, killing 20 of the enemy in close-range combat. Out of ammunition, he threw off his helmet and shoes and hurried barefoot to the beach to resupply himself. He did this 8 times, carrying a wounded man to safety on each trip. Later in the day, he covered the withdrawal of his platoon to the company position, though his weapon was shot from his hands twice. Meanwhile, other brave boys were doing grunt work near the shoreline, work that would get the mechanized part of the assault in motion. Oblivious to the storm of lead and steel, some bent down and shoved wire mats under the treads of mired tanks. Others calmly climbed into bulldozers to begin roughing out the semblance of a road system. These were the instincts of training and courage that took hold as the first shock of battle wore off, courage fueled by a fierce kind of love. There was an incredible bond among guys on that beach, Danny Thomas remembered. We knew each other, We could rely upon each other, trust one another. We had trained together and we were bonded. Death became demystified, an occupational hazard. The Marines quickly saw that even heroes could die. Sergeant John Bazalone, the Medal of Honor winner who had helped change the course of the Guadalcanal battle, was leading a rifle unit along the beach toward a Japanese emplacement. "Come on, you guys! We gotta get these guns off the beach," he called to his men, and then was obliterated by a mortar shell. Moments of valor proliferated. Among the heroes were the men sent to give solace. Corpsman Emery yelled, "Keep down!" to a fellow medic sitting upright in the sand. Crawling closer, he saw that the man was struggling to tie a tourniquet around the stump of his leg. "Take care of the others. I'll be okay," the injured medic called out. When Emery crawled back past the corpsman several minutes later, he was dead. "Dead men were lying around," Ira said later, and the peculiar smell of gunpowder, smoke, and blood was in the air. Father Paul Bradley went in on the third wave. "I was young," he recalled later, "and didn't think about the danger to me. And I was too busy crawling from dying man to dying man. It was always, 'Father, over here!' Once I was kneeling in the sand administering to a guy who'd been hit. There was a loud thud. His eyes closed. He'd been hit again and was dead. 'Father, over here!' someone called. I went on to the next one." One combatant met his fate with supreme elegance. The moment occurred in the air as the first wave of Amtraks headed for shore. The Marine fighter planes were finishing up their low strafing runs, and as the last pilot began to pull his Corsair aloft, Japanese sprang to their guns and riddled the plane with flak. The pilot, Major Ray Dollins, tried to gain altitude as he headed out over the ocean so as to avoid a deadly crash into the Marines headed for the beach, but his plane was too badly damaged. Lieutenant Keith Wells watched it from his Amtrak, with Doc Bradley standing by his side. "We could see him in the cockpit," Wells said, "and he was trying everything. He was heading straight down for a group of approaching tracks filled with Marines. At the last second, he flipped the plane over on its back and aimed it into the water between two waves of tanks. We watched the water exploding into the air." Military personnel listening to the flight radio network from the ships could not only see Dollins go down, they could hear his last words into his microphone. They were a defiant parody. "Oh, what a beautiful morning! Oh, what a beautiful day! I've got a terrible feeling. Everything's coming my way." 8 days earlier, en route to Iwo Jima, Major Dollins had received news of the birth of his first child, a daughter. He was the first 5th Division Marine to die in the battle. In the midst of all this carnage and confusion was my father. My father, with his corpsman's pouch, his Unit 3 slung over his shoulder. The ex-paper boy, on his rounds. He was busy almost from the moment he touched land, although his fellow medic Cliff Langley was busy even sooner. "Cliff hit the beach about 10 seconds before me," Doc told an interviewer some weeks after the battle, "and when I stepped out, he was already treating a casualty." The casualty was a lieutenant shot through the jaw, a disabling wound by its appearance. "Do you want to be evacuated?" Langley asked the man. "No, I'm okay, thanks," the Marine bravely mumbled, and ran back into the battle. Thurman Fogarty, 18 then, remembered the welter of blood that engulfed the Navy doctors and corpsmen as soon as they landed. Fogarty himself was buffeted by the concussions of the big shells coming in and going out, like gusts of a powerful wind. After just a few minutes, he fell to the beach and scraped out as much indentation as he could. Doc Bradley was crouched next to him, attending to a small wound in his own leg. "I happened to look to my left and saw that the Marine next to me had his arm almost blown off," Fogarty said. "It was just dangling from his shoulder. I pointed this out to Doc. He looked up from his own wounds and rolled across my legs to attend the injured Marine. The guy was conscious." Doc calmly put a tourniquet on the stump of the arm and told the guy to hold it. Then he shot him full of morphine and tied the dangling arm to the stump, and then pointed him toward the aid station. After that, Fogarty and my father were separated. Crawling up a terrace, Fogarty spotted a boy whose head had been cut open by shrapnel. The sight nauseated him, and he slid into a shell crater to vomit. There again he found Doc taking care of a man whose chest had been caved in. This sight reactivated Fogarty's heaving. Doc asked me where I was hit, he later remembered. I told him I was just sick. He smiled at me and assured me, "You'll be all right." John Ferdadovich, also 18, would become Easy's first casualty and had need of Doc Bradley nearly as soon as he broke from the water. He recalled it vividly. I heard the mortar. Then I felt a cold chill, the shock to my nervous system as the shrapnel penetrated my arm and leg. I was sliced open from my knee to my buttocks and under my arm. My femur was smashed. Doc came over. He made everyone stay away. He was very forceful and took charge. Then he gave me blood transfusions as I went in and out of consciousness. Then four Marines carried me away to a place on the beach for evacuation. The place where Ferdadovich lay offered no protection from the hellstorm. Every inch of the beach was an active target. Ferdadovich lay on his cot until 4 p.m. and watched death and destruction explode around him. He saw a boatload of Marines lifted out of the water in a giant flash and implode into nothingness. He saw other wounded boys on their stretchers get blown to pieces. He saw kids in the beach detail get hit as they unloaded explosives, their flesh fused to the fireball. The sight that returned to the future teacher most often in memory, however, was a strikingly unlikely one, a glimpse of Harlan Block as Harlan ran past him toward the action. I called up to him. I said, "Hi," Ferdadovich remembered. But he just ran on by. It was the look in his eyes that startled me. He had a glazed, blank look. It was as if memories were coming back to him from past experiences. This surprised me. I later studied psychology, and I realized that those dilated pupils meant he was shocked by something and was transfixed on some image from his past. It was as if the noise of the mortars transported him to a past memory. Ferdadovich later decided that Harlan was summoning up visions of death, the deaths he'd seen on Bougainville, perhaps, or perhaps his own. By noon, the heavy casualties continued, but the threat of annihilation had vanished. 9,000 troops were ashore and counting. The Marines were on Iwo Jima to stay. Through the long afternoon, the American boys held their positions and even advanced, despite the continuing nightmare of fighting an invisible enemy. The Japanese crossfire maintained and even increased its prodigious volume. It came from everywhere on the island. Even the artillery near Kitano Point, nearly 5 miles to the north, was delivering shells in sheets. From the right flank of the plateau-like land on the eastern beaches came automatic weapons fire that swept back and forth. Advancing vehicles were blown up by aircraft bombs embedded in the sand as tank mines. Spider traps and caves linked to the tunneling system were everywhere. They gave the defenders countless places from which to pop up, fire, disappear, and surface again somewhere else. The veteran Marine who'd boasted to my father that he was experienced enough to dodge bullets had not dreamed of what he'd face. The difference between living and dying was sheer luck, many survivors said later. You were a target if you moved, and you were a target if you stayed in place. Some of General Kurabayashi's technical stratagems could almost have been lifted from the science fiction comic books the Marines had read as boys. Many recalled watching in horror as an orifice would reveal itself on the side of Suribachi, a yawning hole in what it appeared to be solid rock. From the hole, the muzzle of a massive gun would appear and discharge a heavy round. Before American artillery could fix on the hole, it would close again. A reinforced metal shield operated like a giant retractable garage door. And yet, as William Wayne recalled, we did what we were ordered to do. We worked our way across the center of that island with machine guns firing at us. We'd jump into a tank ditch for protection, and then our leader would yell, "Mine!" and we'd change direction. We'd blast pillboxes, secure them just like in training. But unlike in training, they'd come alive again and fire at us from the rear. But we made it. We completed that day's mission. We got across the island. 8 battalions were on shore by the afternoon, as were the tank battalions of 2 divisions and elements of 2 artillery battalions. Getting ashore proved more difficult as the day progressed, and not just because of the gunfire. John Grambling recalled that his Amtrak circled for hours in the offshore water. The boys tensed for an incoming shell. "We couldn't get in because of the congestion," he said. "When we hit the beach, there were stacks of bodies." Wesley Coon's track encountered bodies well before it hit the shoreline. "They floated face down because of the air trapped in their backpacks," he said. One of the war correspondents aboard the ships, Robert Sherrod, watched the battle through binoculars. To him, the struggling tanks were like so many black beetles struggling to move on tar paper. At around 5 p.m., Sherrod made ready to board a landing craft to take him ashore. He met Keith Wheeler of the Chicago Times, returning from the beach. "I wouldn't go in there if I were you," Wheeler advised him. "There's more hell in there than I've seen in the rest of the war put together." In the midst of this hell, Harlan was crawling through a trench in the late afternoon, leading a line of boys on all fours. Bill Rannis was directly behind him and collided with him when Harlan stopped abruptly. "We all looked to see what had stopped Harlan," Rannis recalled. He was staring at two legs attached to hips with no upper torso. He was just transfixed, staring silently. To William Wayne, also in the line, the legs were inanimate, something to put out of his mind and move on from. "I was in a survival mode," he said, "and seeing those legs didn't bother me at the time. But to Harlan, they were part of a person." He turned to me after a little while and said softly, "Why don't we bury him?" Variations on such encounters produced varieties of tortured etiquette. Roland Kiasen tumbled into a crater and nearly rolled over a Marine with his right arm blown off. "I felt silly," he recalled. "I didn't know what to say. What do you say to someone who has just lost his right arm?" Mike Strank had performed heroically, shepherding his boys throughout the day, but his grim fatalism had not left him. Aloise Biggs recalled taking a breather in a shell hole with him in the afternoon. In a matter-of-fact voice, Mike said, "This is my third campaign, and I'm not going to make it through this one." "I had been through Bougainville," Biggs said, "and I didn't think much of it at the time." The corpsmen were catching hell along with everyone else. Cliff Langley, Doc's co-medic, was watching six of them in a circle conferring with one another. A shell landed in their midst. "That was the last of them," Langley said. By nightfall, the beachhead was secured. As the sun set, the shoreline grew even more grotesquely clogged with human bodies. Each Marine returning for supplies from the front brought a dead or wounded man with him. Their groans could be heard up and down the shore as darkness set in. Uncounted numbers of them died there, blasted by shells as they lay on their stretchers, waiting to be evacuated to the hospital ships. And still there remained work to be done, for the corpsmen especially. More injured, hundreds more, lay scattered throughout the field of battle. Doc, as senior corpsman for his unit, received reports and assigned help as best he could. A Company, which had landed first and made the heroic charge across to the western beach, was among the most devastated. "Your father sent me over there," Cliff Langley recalled. Their corpsmen were gone and they needed help. They started the day with 250 boys and they were down to 37. They had paid the price for that 700-yard dash across the island. On arriving, Langley encountered 8 walking wounded among the casualties. "They were suffering," he said, "and I gave them tags to identify them as casualties so they could be evacuated. They could have left and received Purple Hearts and held their heads high, but like the lieutenant shot through the jaw in the morning, none of them would go." They stood there, wounded and bleeding, Langley remembered, but they refused to leave their buddies. The first night on Iwo Jima brought its own special horrors. The hellish red comets that had cut the pre-dawn blackness reappeared in the sky intermixed with streaks of white. Tracers. Shells from the offshore destroyers. More than 10,000 rounds. Phosphorus star shells to provide bursts of white light. Searchlights to keep Suribachi illuminated. Parachute flares that made a poof sound when they illuminated, and then floated down slowly. These flares cast an especially eerie glow over the island. As they wafted downward in the wind, their back-and-forth motions made the shadows move and seem to come alive. To Danny Thomas, lying in his foxhole on his back, the night sky was a mesh of hot light, a net of crisscrossing fire. It seemed like you could stick a cigarette up and light it, he said. The leaders of Spearhead hardly rested. Colonel Harry Liversedge moved his command post 200 yards nearer the front to be ready for the next morning's assault on the mountain. In the waters offshore, boats churned through the night, bringing in more of the living, taking away more of the dying. At the White House, President Roosevelt shuddered when told of Iwu's first day. It was the first time in the war, through good news and bad, that anyone had seen the president gasp in horror. The first day's fighting had claimed more than half as many casualties as the entire Guadalcanal campaign. 566 men killed ashore and afloat, and 1,755 wounded. 99 boys had suffered combat fatigue. The remaining troops lay as still as they could, trying to sleep, trying not to sleep. They had been trained to shoot any moving object as the enemy. The falling parachute flares illuminated everything. The shadows darted and slid. Any shadow might be a Japanese soldier crawling softly for the kill. One surgeon had established an operating theater in what he'd thought was a safe area. With sandbags and tarp, he'd fashioned a makeshift hospital. But as he tried to sleep that night, he heard what sounded like foreign voices below him. Was he dreaming? He dug his fingers into the soft ash and felt for evidence. His fingertips scraped something solid. The wooden roof of a reinforced cavern. The surgeon had built his hospital directly atop the enemy. Phil Ward remembered that the passwords for that night were based on American-made cars. Uttering Nash, Plymouth, Chevrolet, or Dodge at a crucial moment could make the difference between life and death. Late in the night, Ward recalls, a guy put a gun to my head and I forgot all the passwords. Somehow he was spared. The first day of the Battle of Iwo Jima had come to an end. There were 35 left to go. Chapter 8. D-Day Plus One. It is good that war is so horrible, or we might grow to like it. Robert E. Lee. Rain greeted the boys of Easy Company as they awoke and looked out at Suribachi's great squat bulk on Tuesday, February 20th. Rain and cold gusts would lash them for the next 3 days. The surf, mercifully calm during the invasion, had risen with the night winds. It roiled and slammed its ugly gray foam onto the beach in 4-foot waves. Now the unloading of equipment would be hampered by more than enemy artillery, and the mood among the high command was grim. It became a fight against the sea, the surf, the volcanic ash, and the Japanese all joined in one colossal alliance against us. General Smith would lament in his memoirs. It had been a chilly, nerve-shattering night. From their position above the western beaches, Mike, Ira, Harlan, and the others could hear the mortar, rocket, and artillery fire from Japanese guns. It did not abate throughout the night. The shells wiped out 2 casualty stations on the assault beach, killing many already wounded men. The young Marines had spent the night braced for a banzai charge. General Smith had warned them to expect it. Such attacks, hordes of Isengorin rushing insanely through the darkness toward the bivouacked Americans, had been routine tactics in other Pacific Island battles. Although terrifying, these charges at least exposed the Japanese soldiers to the Marines' gun sights. Usually the attackers lost many more men than the defenders. "This is usually when we break their backs," Howland Mad Smith observed as he gave orders to prepare. But no attack came. This extension of Kurabayashi's coolly radical, fill-the-beach-and-then-get-them strategy withstood the objections of the traditionalists beneath him. Instead, the mortar and big artillery shells continuing through the night killed more American boys than any banzai charge ever could. And the stealthy menace implied by the flare's eerie glow was real. Not all the shadows were phantoms. At around 2 a.m., a Japanese grenade had landed in Easy's midst and injured Ed Kurelik and Phil Christman. A weary Doc Bradley felt his way through the darkness on his hands and knees to treat the wounded, shouting his name so that he would not be shot as an enemy. Richard Wheeler recalled that Kurelik, a Chicago kid, was steamed that the Japanese had not played fair. "I heard somebody coming up the trench and hollered Studebaker," Kurelik fumed as Doc bound his wounds. "And then that Jap threw a hand grenade." The gray dawn illuminated the night's destruction. To the experienced correspondent Robert Sherrod, who thought he had seen all the worst that the Pacific campaign had to offer, it revealed nothing less than a nightmare in hell. His dispatch continued, "About the beach in the morning lay the dead. They died with the greatest possible violence. Nowhere in the Pacific have I seen such badly mangled bodies. Many were cut squarely in half. Legs and arms lay 50 feet away from any body." Thus, for some Marines who hours earlier had prayed for night, it was now the dawn that proved a blessing. The 28th Regiment, Harry the Horse Liversedge's outfit, had established itself across the narrow neck of the island, isolating Suribachi just a few hundred yards to the south. Now the 3,000 men of the 28th would begin their dangerous advance southward toward the volcano, while the other 33,000 Marines on the island would fight their way north across the island's main mass toward the airfields and the high fortified ground on the northern rim. The cost of taking Suribachi would be high, and the 28th braced itself for the grim assignment. Soon after sunrise on D-Day Plus One, Colonel Liversedge positioned his 2nd and 3rd battalions to continue their assault on Mount Suribachi. Easy Company was not among these units. They were held in regimental reserve. Easy would retrace their steps of the day before, going eastward to position themselves in the 2nd Battalion area. There they would assume a backup position from where they could be rushed into the front lines. The covering bombardment erupted at first light. An airstrike screamed in with the dawn. Navy carrier planes looming out of the wet sky to slam the mountain with rockets, bombs, and napalm blobs. At 8:30, Harry the Horse gave the order to attack, and elements of the 2nd Battalion under Lieutenant Colonel Chandler Johnson and the 3rd Battalion under Lieutenant Colonel Charles Shepard moved out. As the Marines zigzagged their way through the rain toward Suribachi, shells from half-tracks and nearby U.S. destroyers lambasted the mountain. It had little impact on the subterranean enemy. Captain Severance committed Easy's 1st Platoon to the attack early in the day. The platoon leader, Lieutenant George Stoddard, was wounded and evacuated. The ground assault gained less than 75 yards through the morning, and those yards were earned the old-fashioned way, via flamethrowers, handheld guns, and demolitions. Around 11 a.m., Johnson sent a message to 5th Division headquarters, "Enemy defenses much greater than expected. There was a pillbox every 10 feet. Support given was fine, but did not destroy many pillboxes or caves. Groups had to take them step by step, suffering severe casualties." While the attack surged and then stalled, Easy Company, minus the 1st Platoon, continued to pick its way east, always with the mountain and its gunners looming not far away. Contact with the enemy was negligible, except in the case of one Marine from the 3rd Platoon, a blacksmith's son and bona fide eccentric from Montana named Don Rule. Rule had become something of the company oddball during training. He hated wearing a helmet, lectured his buddies that brushing one's teeth only wears them down, and made no secret that he'd had enough training. He was ready to fight. On D-Day, Rule had shown everyone that he was not kidding. Spotting a cluster of 8 Japanese who were fleeing their blown-up blockhouse, the boy charged them by himself, killing one with a bullet and another with a bayonet thrust. Now, at around 11:30 of D+1, Rule came loping up to Easy Company's first sergeant, John Daskalakis, with an equally reckless notion. A Marine lay wounded about 40 yards forward of Easy's position, and Rule wanted permission to bring him in. Several other Marines and corpsmen had already tried this and were driven off, many with wounds by machine gun fire. Sergeant Daskalakis pointed this out to Rule and then told him to go ahead. "He jumped out of the tank trap we were in," Daskalakis recalled, "ran through a tremendous volume of mortar and machine gun fire, and made it to the wounded man's side. Then he half-dragged and half-carried him back." Rule rounded up an assistant and a stretcher and bore the man off, again through heavy fire, to the battalion aid station 300 yards away. Then he sprinted back to the platoon and took his place again. The beach was still hot. Unlike Normandy's beaches, which fell quiet after 24 hours, the Iwo Jima shoreline continued to absorb casualties for days. Corpsman Hector McNeil could never forget the sight of wounded boys on their stretchers being blown to bits by shells. Roy Paramore of Lufkin, Texas, saw Seabees and bulldozer operators killed as he himself unloaded supplies in the firestorm. Father Paul Bradley and his assistant Max Heffley were likewise exposed, preoccupied through the onslaught as they cared for the wounded. Max remembered in particular one young Marine who had stepped on a landmine. "We raised his blanket and saw his legs and one arm were just chopped meat. He wouldn't survive. But he just lay there calmly smoking a cigarette." But up on the front lines, American boys were avenging these losses with a fury. Some of the fiercest of these boys were just that, kids barely out of childhood. Jacqueline Lucas was an example. He'd fast-talked his way into the Marines at 14, fooling the recruiters with his muscled physique and martinet style. He'd attended a military academy before signing up. Assigned to drive a truck in Hawaii, he had grown frustrated. He wanted to fight. He stowed away on a transport out of Honolulu, surviving on food passed along to him by sympathetic leathernecks on board. He landed on D-Day without a rifle. He grabbed one lying on the beach and fought his way inland. Now, on D+1, Jack and three comrades were crawling through a trench when eight Japanese sprang in front of them. Jack shot one of them through the head. Then his rifle jammed. As he struggled with it, a grenade landed at his feet. He yelled a warning to the others and rammed the grenade into the soft ash. Immediately, another rolled in. Jack Lucas, 17, fell on both grenades. "Luke, you're gonna die," he remembered thinking. Jack Lucas later told a reporter, "The force of the explosion blew me up into the air and onto my back. Blood poured out of my mouth and I couldn't move. I knew I was dying." His comrades wiped out the remaining Japanese and returned to Jack to collect the dog tags from his body. To their amazement, they found him not only alive but conscious. Aboard the hospital ship Samaritan, the doctors could scarcely believe it. "Maybe he was too damn young or too damn tough to die," one said. He endured 21 reconstructive operations and became the nation's youngest Medal of Honor winner, and the only high school freshman to receive it. When I asked him 53 years after the event, "Mr. Lucas, why did you jump on those grenades?" he did not hesitate with his answer: "To save my bunnies." In the midst of battle, the Marines buried their dead. Don Mayer, at 19, had never before touched a corpse. On this day, he dragged body after body out of the surf. Kids who drowned jumping from their Amtraks or who had been hit just as they landed. Bob Schmidt of Appleton, Wisconsin, was part of Graves' registration. Like the Kissing Bandit, he'd grown up near Doc but didn't know him. In later years, they would play golf together. His unit was supposed to go in on D-Day, but the beach was so full they didn't make it until 2 p.m. on D+1. "We spent 28 hours in that little Amtrak just circling around," Schmidt said. "It was torture. I would doze off and then be awakened by waves of seasickness. All you could see was the carnage of the landing craft being blown up on the beach." When Bob Schmidt finally went to work, he realized at once that this was a different sort of battle. "I had buried the dead on Saipan," he said, "but the difference was how mangled the bodies were. The Japanese were hitting us with higher caliber weapons than we had ever seen. On Saipan, each Marine was buried in an individual grave, but on Iwo Jima, we'd bulldoze a single grave 100 feet long, 10 feet wide. We didn't bury by grave, we buried by rows. We had surveyors plotting the markers." Chaplain Gage Hodling could never forget the bleak enormity of these mass burials. "We buried 50 at a time in bulldozed plots. We didn't know if they were Jewish, Catholic, or whatever, so we said a general committal. We commit you into the earth and the mercy of Almighty God." I buried 1,800 boys. At about 4 p.m. on D+1, Easy Company received its order to head for the front, with the 2nd and 3rd platoons, plus company machine gun squads supporting each platoon. Its mission was to relieve a unit that had been online for most of the afternoon and taken many casualties. The 2nd Battalion had clawed its way some 100 yards toward Suribachi. The winter sun, which had emerged from the clouds late in the day, had now sunk behind the mountain, and the Marines of Easy moved directly into its giant shadow. Many of the young boys were seized with the feeling that the mountain was looking at them. And in fact, it was, with thousands of eyes, those of the 22,000 Japanese who were barricaded under its surface. Arriving at the front at a running crouch, Richard Wheeler asked a rifleman flat on his stomach, "How's it going up here?" "We're getting shot to hell," snapped the shooter. Almost immediately, Easy was experiencing this truth firsthand. Kenneth Milstead, a second platoon buddy of Mike, Ira, Franklin, and Harlan, had just dropped into a shallow foxhole he dug when a shell landed beside him and blew him out again. Blood streamed from the embedded fragments in his face. "I could have been evacuated," Milstead recalled, "but the Japanese had pissed me off. I went from being scared to being angry. That was the day I became a Marine." Over the boys' heads, rounds from tanks and offshore destroyers slammed into the mountain. "Nothing but noise," Phil Ward recalled. Navy and Marine fighter planes angled in, plastering the steep flanks with napalm that burst in bright orange plumes. On the ground, under fire, my father prowled, his Unit 3 pouch slung over his shoulder, exposed, looking for wounded. "Our sick bay was just a rifle in the ground," recalled Dr. James Whitmire, the battalion surgeon. Doc Bradley came in with another casualty, and since he had been out with the troops so much, I ordered him to rotate to the back and take a breather. He was tired, but he refused to stop. He said, "I don't want to leave my men. I want to stay with them." Then he went back to the fighting. It was a day of heroics and tragedy for Easy Company. Sometimes the two were almost inseparable. As the Marines pushed ever closer to the mountain's base, Lieutenant Ed Pinnell spotted five gravely wounded men in open terrain not far from him. They needed immediate rescue, but they lay under withering crossfire. Pinnell looked around for a solution. A few tanks were finally lumbering toward the field. The nearest was about 100 yards away. Lieutenant Pinnell took out for it on a dead run. Somehow, reaching it unscathed, he grabbed the telephone hanging on its side and guided its driver back to two of the wounded men. Mike, Harlan, Ira, and Franklin dashed to the pair, partly shielded by the tank's bulk, and pulled them into a trench. Pinnell directed the driver to back the tank until it straddled the men, who were then pulled inside through the escape hatch door. The lieutenant then guided another tank toward the other three wounded men and repeated the risky operation twice more. He received a Navy Cross for his valor. And Don Rule remained in a fighting mood. A large Japanese gun was in place about 75 yards from the company's right flank. A company next to Easy had taken 7 casualties in an attempt to rush and neutralize it. Now the toothbrush-hating Rule and a buddy came up to Lieutenant Keith Wells, the 3rd Platoon leader, and offered their services. As dozens of their fellow Marines watched, the two boys sprinted across territory that had cost other American boys their lives. Reaching the big gun, they found its emplacement unoccupied. The two stayed in the emplacement beside the weapon through the night to prevent the Japanese from reoccupying it. Rooting in the darkness, Rule found a tunnel not far away. With no apparent thought that it might be occupied by extremely unfriendly tenants, the eccentric Montana boy crawled inside and explored its entire length with lighted matches. He discovered several woolen blankets and brought them back to his dumbfounded comrades. As Suribachi's shadow spread into general darkness, Easy Company dug in for another cold, sleepless night. The fatigued boys knew what lay in store when the winter sun rose again. They knew that in the morning their battalion would have to assault the mountain, and that they would be part of the assault force. Again, the star shells, the flares, and the searchlights conjured vast, jumping shadows on Suribachi's sides to bedevil the boys' night thoughts. As if to provide a soundtrack for those thoughts, a Japanese mortar shell hit an ammunition dump on the beach late in the night. The explosions continued for an hour. By the end of this day, the 4th and 5th Divisions controlled only 1.5 miles of the island. For this territory, the 5th Division had suffered some 1,500 casualties, and the 4th about 2,000. And still the Americans could not see their enemy, could see little evidence that they had inflicted casualties. For most of the young boys, it had not fully sunk in yet that the defenders were not on Iwu, they were in Iwu, prowling the 16 miles of catacombs. Psychologically, it was as though they were shooting at and getting shot by phantoms. And now, in the darkened land of the phantoms, in the madman's haunted house, the boys tried once again to sleep. Chapter 9. D-Day Plus 2. Some people wonder all their lives if they've made a difference. The Marines don't have that problem. Ronald Reagan. A storm lashed in from the ocean. Blasts of wind. The surf at 6 feet. But this was nothing compared to the hellstorm about to erupt on the southern neck of the island. At 8:30 a.m., a thin line of unprotected American boys would arise and rush directly at the most fortified mountain in the history of the world. Almost one-third of them would be killed or maimed, but not in vain. Their charge would mark the beginning of the end for impregnable Suribachi, and thus for Iwo Jima itself as a factor in the war. Soaked, cold, and fatigued, the Marines awoke and gazed toward the primitive mass of rock that held their fates. In the tense silence as first light broke, Easy Company lay poised for action on the 2nd Battalion's right flank. Easy faced a long, lethal gauntlet on the volcano's northeastern side. Dave Severance's boys would have to rush across 200 yards of open terrain toward the mountain's base with very little cover of any kind. The guns trained down on the 200 yards between the 28th Regiment and the mountain's base would soon make those yards the worst killing ground in the Pacific. Only after the battle would Americans grasp the full extent of what had been concentrated against them. Suribachi's interior had been hollowed out into a fantastical seven-story subterranean world, fortified with concrete revetments and finished off with plastered walls, a sewer system, and conduits for fresh air, electricity, water, and steam. As many as 1,300 Japanese soldiers and 640 Navy troops filled each of the various rooms and tunnels. They were armed with guns of every conceivable size and design. The terrain below this fortress, the ground between the Marines and the mountain, was not only barren of natural cover, it lay in the teeth of overlapping ground fire. At the mountain base stretched a welter of reinforced concrete pillboxes and infantry trenches. The firing ports of the pillboxes were angled so that the Japanese shooters could see one another and offer mutual support with their spewing machine guns. At a little after 7:30 a.m., the Marines' own artillery opened its earth-shattering barrage. Hot, friendly metal streaked low over the Marines' heads, splintering the rock on the side of the mountain. The boys on the perimeter ducked under the lethal salvos. Shrapnel was a fickle friend. "Ask for all of it," Harry the Horse had yelled at his operations officer. There was no reason to hold back. After this day, there would be no space between the Marines and the enemy to aim shells. The combat could be hand-to-hand. Toward the end of the barrage, 40 carrier planes screamed in low, drilling the mountain with rockets that exploded at an ear-splitting pitch. Some of the bombs landed a football field's length away from the crouching Marines. The planes pulled away. H-hour drew near. 8 a.m. The boys braced themselves with a cry of attack that might usher in their last moments on Earth. But no attack order came. The problem was tanks. Colonel Livershedge had expected several to arrive to cover the assault, but none had appeared. Rearming and refueling problems and Japanese mortar harassment had kept them pinned down. Harry the Horse delayed the assault until 8:15, hoping that at any moment the mechanized monsters would grind into view. Nothing. At 8:30, Colonel Livershedge made a harrowing decision. Despite the crucial absence of armor to cover the charging boys, he could afford to wait no longer. He gave the order to go. An electric current of pure terror pulsed across the regiment. The Marines could see that the tanks were not in the field. No tanks, no large, bulky shapes to protect the boys against fire from the pillboxes as they ran. No tanks, nothing but bodies against bullets. A certainty of death filled the air. No jaunty war cries came from the veterans. Richard Wheeler experienced a pang of utter hopelessness. I could feel fear dragging at my jowls. Lieutenant Keith Wells would later admit to a memory from his boyhood in his father's slaughterhouse, an awareness among the cattle as the doors closed behind them of what lay in store. And then the heroes of the day began literally to stand up and be counted. One of the first was Lieutenant Keith Wells of Easy Company's 3rd Platoon. Wells did not tell his men to follow him. He simply got to his feet, waved his gun toward the mountain, and began running. I just thought it was pure suicide, he later recalled. His mute example stirred the troops. Behind him, hundreds of scared boys stood up, leveled their rifles, and advanced against the mountain. To the left of Wells's 3rd Platoon with Doc Bradley was Lieutenant Ed Pinnell's 2nd Platoon with Mike, Harlan, Ira, and Franklin, matching Wells's advance step by step. The mountain exploded back at them, a screaming death. Harlan, Doc, Ira, and Franklin swept forward with the rest of Easy Company in the vanguard of the attack. Immediately, Japanese shells and bullets began cutting the Americans down. Amidst the din, the air was cut with kids' strangled voices calling, "Corman! Corman!" Officers and enlisted men crumpled together under the hailstream of steel, were blown to bits, were machine-gunned where they crouched, were sliced open by hot shards. Clusters of men were raked and raked again. In Corporal Richard Wheeler's area, a mortar shell killed Corporal Edward J. Romero, an ex-paratrooper from Chicago. Wheeler dove into a crater and had scarcely recovered his wits when another shell exploded, ripping the future writer's left jawline apart. As the blood spurted, Corpsman Clifford Langley, who had treated a jaw wound on D-Day, hurried to Wheeler's side and applied compresses. Then Langley gave aid to a wounded man nearby. As he was closing his pouch and preparing to leave the crater, Wheeler's rifle in his hand, yet another mortar shell burst upon them. This one ripped Wheeler's left calf apart and drove shrapnel into Langley. The young corpsman ignored his own wounds and once again dressed Wheeler's laceration. Then they both realized that the shell had done its worst work on the wounded man nearby. Both his legs had been ripped open and he lay on his stomach, conscious but slowly dying. It wasn't over yet. Now a fourth mortar hurtled in. It landed with a thump. A dud. Had it been live, it would have killed everyone near it. Corpsman Langley, his clothing now soaked with his own blood, once again methodically closed his pouch, grabbed Wheeler's rifle, and went on his way. William Wayne saw a bullet take a buddy's face off. His teeth were just lying there, Wayne said. If I'd thought about it at the time, it would have driven me crazy. Yesterday's heroes became today's dead. Don Rule's eccentric bravado finally got the better of him. It happened early on. Rule and his platoon guide, Sergeant Henry Hansen, were in the forefront of a charge that reached the brushy fringe of the mountain's base. They rushed past bunkers that had been blasted by the bombing, but soon found themselves at close quarters with active defenders. The two leaped atop a disabled pillbox and emptied their rifles into a cluster of Japanese who were hurling hand grenades. As they blasted away, a grenade clunked down between them. Eyewitnesses recall that Rule, who was near the roof's edge, could easily have slid over the side and escaped harm. But that was not his nature. He sized up Hansen's position, helplessly isolated near the center of the roof, and acted. With a shout of warning, "Watch out, Hank!" he flung himself on the charge. Sergeant Hansen recalled seeing the charge land, realizing he was trapped, flattening himself out, hoping the fragments would pass over me, and hearing Rule's warning almost in the same instant. "I heard the muffled explosion," Hansen said in his official report of the incident. "I pulled Rule off the bunker, but he was dead. I am positive that had it not been for the self-sacrifice of his life, I would have been killed or seriously wounded." Among the first to reach Rule's body was Doc Bradley, who held the dead boy in his arms while he examined him for signs of life. For his bravery, Don Rule received a posthumous Medal of Honor. The chain reaction of slaughter continued on. When Wheeler received his jaw wound, a comrade named Louis Adrian, a Spokane Indian, scrambled out of that foxhole and dove into another. There crouched his best buddy, Chick Robeson. The two Washington boys had enlisted together, traveled to Camp Pendleton together by train, and shared a tent in training. On Liberty in California one night, feeling no pain, they fell asleep on a beach. They awoke when a huge wave crashed over them. Now the two comrades were shoulder to shoulder, firing and tossing grenades, taking turns popping up and down in the cold, driving rain. "I came down to reload and Louis went up," Robeson recalled. "Then a bullet got him right in the heart. He fell and turned yellow with death. Louis was my best friend, my link with home. I was staring at him when our corporal yelled, 'Move, Chick! Move! Move!'" And so 17-year-old Chick Robeson stood up and charged forward. He was a Marine, and he had work to do. The 2nd Platoon, fighting hard on the left, found itself under a concentrated mortar barrage. barrage. Ira, Franklin, Harlan, and Mike zigzagged from one shell hole to another as they bore forward, looking for any sort of protection. Around them, their friends were suffering and dying as Easy took a cluster of casualties. A mortar round blew two boys to bits. An artillery round landed near Tex Stanton. The concussion blew Tex 10 feet in the air. He fell to earth with deep burns on his legs and hips. And still they advanced, even as their casualties mounted at a rate that would have caused panic and retreat in nearly any other attacking force. These Marines remembered their training at Camps Pendleton and Tarawa and kept moving forward. Stoically, they followed their assigned roles and maintained the intricate teamwork of the great assaulting organism. The riflemen and machine gunners who survived the charge aimed their fire at individual blockhouse ports, often mere slits in the hardened igloos. And as the enemy ducked, if the enemy ducked, the surviving demolition squads and the flamethrowers moved in through the chattering crossfire to get close enough for extermination. In the midst of the carnage, Doc Bradley ran through the chaos, doing what he could in this landscape of blood. Just 30 minutes into the charge, the wet terrain was strewn with American bodies. Now the peaceable newsboy ignored the bullets and tried to save lives. He watched a Marine blunder into a crossfire of machine gun bursts and slump to the ground. Doc did not hesitate. His telltale Unit 3 bag slapping at his side, my father sprinted through 30 yards of saturating crossfire, mortars and machine guns to the wounded boy's side. As bullets whined and pinged around him, Doc found the Marine losing blood at a life-threatening rate. Moving him was out of the question until the flow was stanched. The Japanese gunfire danced all around him, but Doc focused his mind on his training. He tied a plasma bottle to the kid's rifle and jammed it bayonet first into the ground. He moved his own body between the boy and the sheets of gunfire. Then, his upper body still erect and fully exposed, he administered first aid. His buddies watching him from their shell holes were certain that he would be cut down at any moment. But Doc Bradley stayed where he was until he thought it was safe to move the boy. Then he raised a hand, signaling his comrades not to help but to stay low. And then my father stood up into the merciless firestorm and pulled the wounded Marine back across the 30 yards to safety, by himself. His attention did not flicker until the Marine was safely evacuated. This action, so heroic that two sergeants and Captain Severance came forward to report it, earned him his Navy Cross, an honor he never mentioned to our family. It was one of the bravest things my father ever did. And it happened on one of the most valorous days in the history of a corps known for valor. Among the many heroes on the field, none surpassed the sustained courage of Lieutenant Keith Wells, Don Rule's 3rd Platoon leader, and the man who had stood up to inspire the initial charge. Wells took a terrific hit in the early fighting. It happened as Easy, slogging with ferocious intent toward the entrenched defenders, outpaced the unit on its right flank and began taking fire not only from the front but from the side as well. Soon the company was pinned down by grenades and bullets from a blockhouse in its path. Worse, it came under a pinpoint barrage of close-in mortar fire. Two kids volunteered to the rear for more grenades. They were gunned down from the blockhouse. Flamethrowers Chuck Lindbergh and Robert Good rushed to the scene but could not get through the mortar fire to the emplacement. Then a shell burst near Lieutenant Wells, wounding him and 4 other men, including William Wayne. Wells suffered shrapnel wounds to his legs and lost some of his clothing. Doc Bradley darted to his side, injected him with morphine, and told him to get the hell to the rear. Wells would have none of it. His unit had begun the morning with 42 men. 25 now remained. No one could be spared. The feeling had returned to his legs, and he decided to stay in the field, in command. Lieutenant Wells' determination drove his men to new heights of valor. Lindbergh and Good arose with their deadly flamethrowers and, ignoring the sheets of fire directed at them, stalked toward the pillbox. Soon the two were squirting their molten fire streams in all directions. They not only incinerated dozens of Japanese, the smell of burnt flesh floated on the damp wind, their liquid fire turned several pillboxes into infernos, causing Japanese ammunition to explode in great bursts. Chuck Lindbergh later recalled the hazards of lugging a tank that carried 72 pounds of jellied gasoline, napalm, under 1,200 pounds of pressure. The shot only lasted 6 seconds, he recalled. We fired in short bursts. It was dangerous work. A lot of guys bought the farm trying that. Lindbergh's steely calm and ferocious concentration led him to heights of accomplishment that few others attained. His day's work earned him a Silver Star. The roar of tank treads now competed with the din of artillery all along the Marines' front as dozens of them belatedly joined the front line. Shielded by the armored bulk, infantrymen could rush ever closer to pillboxes and bunkers without being exposed to fire. The inhabitants of those hovels, those who were not gunned down or scorched to death, began to flee toward the mountain. The Japanese first-line defenses were crumbling. But the price of this victory remained high, and heroes continued to suffer. Five of the flag raisers fought side by side, led by Lieutenants Wells and Pennell. And now Pennell himself was a lacerated casualty, needing rescue. He was dashing from shell hole to shell hole when a shell landed between his legs and blew him a distance of 30 feet. His left heel was blown off, his right buttock and thigh gouged out, and his left shin pierced by shrapnel. Half a century later, Pennell told the story with detached humor. "I was semi-conscious. I heard someone screaming. Then I realized it was me. I felt liquid running down my butt, and I thought my life juices were running out. I looked between my legs to see what I had left. It was okay. It was my damaged canteen leaking." A medic came by and gave me a brandy and a shot of morphine. I took my helmet off and put it over my genitals. I laid there in a depression like a soup tureen for hours. Parts of my body blown off, no clothes, helmet over my privates. I laid there with everything exploding around me. An amphibious tractor tried to reach him. It hit a mine and blew up, killing the boys inside. Several hours later, four Marines approached him with a poncho. They rolled him onto it, each grabbed a corner, and they set off for the beach. A bullet wounded one of the carriers, and Pennell toppled heavily to the ground. The remaining three men dragged him to the beach. He lay there on a stretcher until darkness. "I felt exposed," he said, "like I was on a platform for all to see. Those flat trajectory shells would skim straight in, making a roaring sound in the dark. Foom, foom, foom. Guys were being killed all around me. It was complete chaos." Finally, Lieutenant Pennell was loaded with some other wounded boys onto a long pallet. An Amtrak rushed them to an offshore hospital ship where the pallets were hooked with wires and winched up to the main deck. "A wire broke that was pulling the pallet just before mine," the lieutenant remembered. "Those guys screamed and just sank to the bottom." Lieutenant Pennell's ordeal was not yet over. As a doctor examined him, a Japanese shell crashed onto the deck and skidded into the fuel bunker. The doctor turned and stood with his stethoscope pressed to the bunker, listening to the shell as it rolled around, doubtless wondering whether he and everyone nearby was about to be blown up. But it was a dud. "It had been a long day," Ed Pennell told me later. Soaked with blood, nearly immobilized by pain, Keith Wells continued to direct the 3rd Platoon's attack through the late morning. But he grew weak. He fell once, dashing to elude gunfire, and reopened his festering wounds. Immediately Doc Bradley was at his side. Doc dosed him up with morphine again, meanwhile screaming, "Enough! Get out of here!" Wells willed himself to stay in the field another half hour, directing assault groups and rallying his men. Finally, half delirious with pain and confident of victory, he turned his command over to Platoon Sergeant Ernest Boots Thomas and made for an aid station in the rear. He got there by crawling. He was awarded a Navy Cross. As rainy morning wore into afternoon and the fighting bogged down, the Marines continued to take casualties. Often it was the corpsmen themselves who died as they tried to preserve life. William Hoops of Chattanooga was crouching beside a medic named Kelly, who put his head above a protective ridge and placed binoculars to his eyes, just for an instant, to spot a sniper who was peppering his area. In that instant, the sniper shot him through the Adam's apple. Hoops, a pharmacist made himself, struggled frantically to save his friend. "I took my forceps and reached into his neck to grasp the artery and clinch it off," Hoops recalled. "His blood was spurting. He had no speech, but his eyes were on me. He knew I was trying to save his life. I tried everything in the world. I couldn't do it. I tried. The blood was so slippery. I couldn't get the artery. I was trying so hard. And all the while he just looked at me. He looked directly into my face. The last thing he did, as the blood spurts became less and less, was to pat me on the arm as if to say, "That's all right." Then he died. The near misses were nearly as ghastly, especially the ones that resulted in other deaths. Donald Howell's buddy, Walter Gust, took a piece of shrapnel in the side of the head. It did not fracture his skull, but for a moment he was incoherent, flailing around. Howell and some buddies tackled him and were taking him to a corpsman when another round exploded, blowing Howell into the air and nearly taking Gust's arm off. The Marines reloaded Gust onto a stretcher. Then a machine gun burst killed the stretcher bearers and ripped apart Gust's other arm. "I was watching this," recalled Howell, "and there was nothing I could do about it. Walter survived. He lived near me for years. I was the best man at his wedding." By late in the bloody afternoon, the conquest of the mountain seemed within the Americans' grasp. Marine discipline and the sacrificial bonding of ardent young men was prevailing over concrete, steel, and thick volcanic rock. But the Japanese, even as their ingenious fortifications crumbled or were scorched hollow, were not quite done with their own desperate resolve. As the 28th continued to inch forward, Navy observation planes above the battle radioed that a swarm of Japanese had emerged from inside the mountain and was forming up for the dreaded Banzai attack. Within minutes, American planes were swooping in low to strafe the area. Their tremendous roar and the concussion of exploding rockets reverberated among the close-by Marines. Finally, the planes banked and vanished, and for a few moments the battlefield was silent, tense with expectation. It was Sergeant Mike Strank, with the 2nd Platoon now on the left side of the line, who broke the spell. Leaping to his feet, the Czech-born Marine bellowed, "Let's show these bastards what a real Banzai is like. Easy Company, charge!" With that, the bone-tired, battle-scarred Marines got to their feet and once again slogged forward into the line of fire. To the right of the 2nd Platoon, the 3rd, commanded now by Boots Thomas, joined the foot race to Suribachi. Boots Thomas was the next hero to shine. With rough terrain stalling the tank some 75 yards to the rear, the 20-year-old Floridian saw that his riddled unit was grievously exposed once again. In the thick of battle, a daring solution came to him. He sprinted back through fire to the nearest tank and, still out in the open, directed its fire against the stubborn pillboxes. Then he dashed back to the front to exhort his men. A bit later, he headed for the tanks again. He repeated this action several times. His example paid off. The 3rd Platoon virtually annihilated the very enemy that had been massing for devastation of its own. As darkness on this triumphant, bloody day was setting in, Thomas himself identified the weak spot in the defensive line and personally led the breakthrough to Suribachi's steep flank, waving his knife aloft in victory. Boots was recommended for a Navy Cross, which was awarded. Suribachi had not fallen. Not quite, not yet, but victory now seemed inevitable. The wet day ended with the 28th Regiment poised in a vast semicircle around the battered volcano's base, gathering its strength for the finishing assault, expected to come the next morning. For Easy Company, it had been a day of grievous loss and historic valor. For its day's work, the badly decimated unit would receive a Medal of Honor, 4 Navy Crosses, 2 Silver Stars, and a number of Purple Hearts. One of the most decorated engagements in the history of the United States Marine Corps. These honors were paid for in blood. Casualties for the day amounted to 30% of Easy's strength. Easy Company had actually moved a little too far and too fast for its own nighttime protection. Dave Severance's boys had penetrated past some active Japanese units and spent the night isolated from the battalion. They huddled on a strip of jagged, rocky terrain at the southern base of Suribachi, the roaring surf of the Pacific below them on the opposite side. Dave Severance set his command post as close as possible to the mountain so that he would have a line of sight up its flank. In the late evening, searchlights from the offshore destroyer escort ships revealed something that looked like Japanese moving into view above Easy. As the ships began tattooing the volcano's flanks with 40-millimeter shells, Captain Severance moved his command post back 30 yards to the water's edge for a better view of the volcano's slopes. It was a good thing he did. The next morning's light would reveal that the original CP site lay buried under several tons of rocks from a bombardment-triggered slide. Low on ammunition and food, Easy's troops munched what was left of their chocolate bars and waited for yet another dawn on Iwo Jima. The Marines had paid for their advances across all fronts on the island with heavy losses. Official casualties for the battle now stood at 644 killed, 4,168 wounded, and 560 unaccounted for. Howland Mad Smith himself was sobered by what he had witnessed. Watching the Marines cross that island, he later told a newspaper reporter, reminded me of the charge of Pickett at Gettysburg. But the horrors of this day's fighting did not end with the darkness. Just as dusk fell, an air raid signal alerted the ships offshore. To Don Mayer of Portland, 19 then, it made a spectacular show. Every ship was firing thousands of tracers, he said. It was more beautiful than any 4th of July you've ever seen. To the boys on board the Task Force ships, the sight was not quite so beautiful. Cecil Gentry, a radio operator on the USS Lawrence Taylor, could not move when the order to hit the deck came from his captain. I was transfixed, he said. I just stood there. One plane flew right over my head. I could see the face of the Japanese pilot. You could see the fear of death on his face. His lips were pulled back over his teeth. This pilot immolated himself against the USS Bismarck Sea, adjacent to the Lawrence Taylor. Four of the ship's own torpedoes detonated in the concussion, and the great ship exploded in huge sheets of orange flame and rapidly sank, its bow turning straight down as it slid under the rough waves laced with rain. The men of the Taylor managed to rescue about 120 of the 800 crewmen from the water. Other rescuers managed to save hundreds more. Cecil Gentry recalled watching corpsmen amputating sailors' legs with razor blades, saws, and meat cutters from the galley. But more than 200 were lost as the Japanese planes strafed the waters. Back on land, the chilled, hungry, and exhausted Marines faced a different kind of nocturnal menace. Fear of infiltrators, the fear of the dancing shadows, had preoccupied the Americans on each night since D-Day. On this night, the fear took on more justification than ever before. On this night, the madman in the haunted house unleashed all his ghouls. Prowling Wolves was the name that General Kurabayashi had given his teams of stalking, crawling night murderers. Now, desperate to save their mountain fortress, they crept out in force. At around 9 p.m. up north with the 26th Marines, Thomas Mayers of the Bronx was surveying the terrain from his foxhole when a flare exploded in the mist. It illuminated a horrible sight, accompanied now by screams, two Japanese slashing two helpless boys in the next foxhole with bayonets. Their names were Krall and Dortch. Mayers and his buddy leaped to their feet to take action. One of the wolves wheeled and hurled a grenade at them. It was a dud, but it struck the other Marine in the head and knocked him unconscious. Mayers squeezed off one round before his rifle jammed. The predators were now advancing on him. The 20-year-old private groped for his hand grenades. The Japanese were so close that throwing the explosives was out of the question. Mayers ripped out their firing pins, scattered them at the edge of his foxhole, and ducked. The enemy soldiers howled and collapsed, their legs full of shrapnel. Mayers climbed from his foxhole and with his knife cut their throats. Then he sprinted to the other foxhole. Krull was dead. Mayers shouted to the lacerated Dortch, "Do you have any guns?" "Yes," the boy murmured. "Krull has a .45 in his shirt." Mayers snatched the weapon. It was slathered with Krull's blood and would not fire. Two more Japanese were now upon Mayers. He rolled a few more grenades at them and ducked through the explosions and then finished them off with his knife. Thomas Mayers received a Navy Cross for his actions. He has never forgotten the moment-to-moment sequence of that bloody episode. Krull, a freckle-faced Irish boy not more than 18 years old, was screaming as he died. And his words would forever haunt Mayers. "Mom! Mom! He's killing me! Mom, he's killing me!" Chapter 10 D-Day Plus 3 It wasn't a matter of living or dying or fighting. It was a matter of helping your friend. Corpsman Robert DeGuss. A lull after the hellstorm of the previous day, and a terrible day for capturing a mountain. The heaviest and coldest rain since D-Day lashed at the surviving Marines. The surf, whipped by 20-knot winds, rolled in on 9-foot crests. The rain made a black stew of the volcanic ash underfoot and waterlogged many of the Americans' weapons. Easy Company, clinging wetly to its isolated post, began D+3 by nearly getting wiped out by friendly fire. The Navy sent their carrier bombers in to bomb the volcano, as Captain Severance recalled it. The pilots must have seen us as live Japanese targets and started dropping 100-pound bombs on our positions. Severance ordered red flares fired to warn the bombers off. No one could find cartridges for the rifle grenade flares. The bombs fell nearer. Radio connections to battalion headquarters had gone dead. More explosions. Desperate for relief, Severance put in a call to Harry the Horse himself on the colonel's private radio frequency. "Red Wing 6," the captain shouted. "This is Bayonet Easy 6. Friendly planes are bombing the hell out of us. Over." Back came the courteous reply from one of the colonel's radio men. "Bayonet Easy 6, this is Red Wing 6. You are not authorized to come up on this frequency. Out." Luckily for Easy Company, Lieutenant Colonel Chandler Johnson happened to be standing near the radio operator. He personally saw to it that the Navy planes were diverted before they caused any casualties. Now that it was wide awake, Easy Company prepared for a day of consolidation as the American ground troops waited out the weather. Lieutenant Colonel Johnson ordered Severance to reorganize and resupply his unit. The captain sent a patrol around the southern base of Suribachi to seek a link-up with the 3rd Battalion and to probe for enemy soldiers in the caves along the base of the volcano. As the day progressed, sporadic firefights broke out around the volcano's base on the west side, Easy's peerless flamethrowers, clicking death in 6-second bursts, scorched out some caves on the south and east sides. Suribachi was surrounded now by American troops, and the invaders' heavy equipment operated almost without resistance. Tanks, howitzers, and other big-bore weapons slammed hot rocks, as though it were a target on a firing range. Battalion officers moved their command posts up to the brush line at the base of the slopes. Amphibious vehicles churned back and forth between the beaches and the front, bringing food and ammunition at will. Demolition specialists converged on pillboxes and bunkers with a vengeance, relishing their payback for the volume of slaughter those emplacements had dealt out. Sometimes a concealed Japanese soldier, seeing that his position was overrun, would make a sudden, desperate break through the Marines for safety. His fate would usually be an M1 rifle bullet. One Japanese officer brandished his samurai sword as he made his break for it. A bad mistake. A Marine, seething with 4 days' worth of grief and terror, grabbed the blade out of the samurai's hands and sliced its owner to death with it. The Marine's hands were badly lacerated, but he held onto the sword as a souvenir. Many of the enemy simply remained in the ground. Their muffled voices and the sounds of their movement added an eerie note to the mopping-up exercises. "We could hear them talking and moving right under our feet," one Marine recalled. "Right under what we thought was solid rock. We'd dig down and find a rafter. Then we'd lower explosives or pour in gasoline. Then they made a lot more noise." The combat-weary boys dealt in various ways with the memories of what they'd seen and done. Some talked to chaplains. Some lost themselves in their duties. For Ira Hayes, it was his edgy gallows humor that provided the shield against utter darkness. As Easy Company regathered itself at the base of Suribachi, Ira grew absorbed in shaping little mounds of earth with his hands. To Joe Rodriguez, they looked like fresh-dug graves, and in fact, that seemed to be what Ira intended. When Franklin Sousley wandered past, Ira made a show of playing taps. Then he said to the Kentuckian, "This is just in case I'm not around when you get it." Franklin just kicked the mounds over, Rodriguez recalls. The impending conquest of Suribachi was far from the only action on Iwo Jima. To the north, the main force of Marines had been battling with equal valor and sustaining equally severe casualties. By the end of D+3, the volcano known as Hot Rocks was surrounded, except for a 400-yard gap on the western coast. Surrounded, but still dangerous. Some of the defenders who remained were still determined killers, and no one knew when or where one might emerge with a grenade or a machine gun. As night fell, however, the Japanese themselves greatly reduced that danger via a highly uncharacteristic action, voluntary abandonment. It involved only half the remaining force, but it amounted to an acknowledgement that the mountain fortress was finished. The order was given by Suribachi's commanding officer, Colonel Kanehiko Atsuchi. As 150 soldiers burst from the mountain in a desperate race to join up with the forces to the north, they were cut to pieces by Marines only too happy to deal at last with a visible enemy. Only about 25 made it through the gauntlet. When they arrived at the headquarters of the Japanese Navy Guard, their reception was not much better. The captain in charge, Samaji Inouye, accused their lieutenant of being a traitor and unsheathed his sword to behead the man. The lieutenant meekly bowed his neck, but a junior officer stopped him before he could swing his blade. Captain Inouye then collapsed in uncontrollable sobs. "Suribachi's fallen," he moaned. "Suribachi's fallen." Earlier that afternoon, the American command had reached the same opinion, in a different frame of mind. Harry the Horse Liversedge received orders that the mountain be seized. Harry paid a visit to Colonel Johnson at his 2nd Battalion headquarters and issued a terse command. "Tomorrow we climb." Chapter 11. So every son of a bitch on this whole cruddy island can see it. I saw some guy struggling with a pole and I just jumped in to lend them a hand. It's as simple as that. Doc Bradley. It hulked above them still, before daybreak on the fifth morning, this primitive serpent's head that had struck them down in swathes. Amputated from the body, bombed, blasted, bayoneted, burnt, Suribachi at last lay silent after 4 days of being killed. But was it dead? Was the grotesque head finally a carcass? Or was there venom still inside and strength to lash yet again? There was only one way for the Marines to find out. They would tread on the head and see whether it writhed. February 23, 1945, dawned cold and stormy like the other days on Iwo Jima, but by mid-morning the rain had stopped and the skies were clearing. Hot rocks glowed early. Navy planes lit it up with napalm at dawn. It was a sheet of flames, remembered Donald Howell, who had relaxed with House Madam before the invasion. An amazing pounding, agreed Max Heffley. But around 9 a.m. the pounding stopped, the serpent's head lay mute and enigmatic, and the dangerous probing by foot began. The pugnacious Colonel Johnson, wearing his trademark soft cap with the visor flipped up, called for 2 4-man patrols to reconnoiter routes up the northern face of Suribachi. Only Fox Company's patrol made it to the top. The leader was Sergeant Sherman B. Watson. The others were George Mercer from Iowa, Ted White from Kansas City, and Louis Charlo from Montana. Tensely, grabbing at roots and rocks for balance, braced for ambush at every step, Watson's patrol felt its way upward amid the smoking rubble. The serpent lay dormant. The hostile fire never materialized. With the courage and discipline born of combat, Sergeant Watson and his boys ventured all the way to the volcano's lip and even risked a look into the crater, a satisfying mass of wreckage, before scrabbling back down to the base and reporting to Chandler Johnson. As he observed Sergeant Watson descending, Colonel Johnson calculated he could risk a larger force and grabbed a field telephone. He cranked it to full battery power and yelled an order through the fuzzy wires to Dave Severance, who was bivouacked with Easy Company, still hugging the rocks on the southeastern point. "Send me a platoon." Severance surveyed his troops. The second platoon, Mike with Harlan, Franklin, and Ira, was off on a probe around Suribachi's base. The first was encamped several dozen yards away. So Severance chose the survivors of the third, Doc's platoon, the closest to Colonel Johnson's command post, to become the first American platoon to climb the mountain. The ranks of the third had been shredded by combat, so Severance augmented the platoon with 12 men from his machine gun platoon and several 60-millimeter mortar section men. This increased the platoon's strength to 40 men. Harry the Horse Liversedge himself picked the leader, First Lieutenant H. George Schreier, Severance's executive officer. Liversedge had known Schreier when they served in the Marine Raiders together, admired his combat experience, and valued the lieutenant's knowledge of how to direct air, artillery, and naval fire by radio. No one was ready to believe that the serpent had finished striking. Just before the 40-man patrol began its climb, Chandler Johnson turned to his adjutant, Lieutenant Greeley Wells, and asked Wells to hand him something from his map case. Then Johnson called Lieutenant Schreier aside and gave him the object. "If you get to the top," the colonel told Schreier, "put it up." What Johnson handed the lieutenant was an American flag, one that Greeley Wells had brought ashore from the USS Missoula. The flag was a relatively small one, measuring 54 by 28 inches. Dave Severance never forgot the wording of that command. "He didn't say, 'when you get to the top,'" the captain pointed out. "He said, 'if.'" The platoon made ready to start its trek. I imagine my father looking around for his buddy, Ralph Ignatowski, Iggy. A Marine staff sergeant named Lewis Lowry, a photographer for Leatherneck magazine, asked permission to come along and record the ascent. The boys in the unit glanced upward, measuring what lay ahead. It was Boots Thomas, appropriately, who got the unit moving. "Patrol up the hill. Come on, let's move out." "I thought I was sending them to their deaths," Dave Severance would later admit to me. "I thought the Japanese were waiting for a larger force." As the 40-man line snaked upward, gained altitude, and grew visible against the near-vertical face of the mountain, it attracted attention. Marines on the beaches and on the flat terrain to the north turned to watch. Even men aboard the offshore ships put binoculars to their eyes to follow the thin line's winding trek. Nearly everyone had the same thought. They're going to get it. The men on the march shared this sense of dread. Had Harold Keller happened to glance at the two stretchers being sent along as the platoon fell into line, I thought to myself, "We'll probably need a hell of a lot more than that," he recalled. Doc Bradley, shouldering his Unit 3 bag, was another who wondered how many would return alive. "Down at the base, there wasn't one out of 40 of us who expected to make it," he told an interviewer not long after the battle. "We all figured the Japanese would open up from caves all the way up to the crater." And my father had an additional concern. All the way up, I kept wondering, how the devil was I going to get the casualties down? Don Howell marked the slow, wary progress. "We inched our way up," he recalled, "blowing caves as we went. We'd see a cave ahead of us, pull the pin on a grenade, and throw it inside." As he passed the cave entrances, Howell could see that they were strewn with empty sake bottles, the Japanese liquor of choice, and bags of plain rice. Phil Ward never forgot how the platoon wound its way cautiously, single file. There was no trail, and there was a lot of blasted rock. We zigzagged our way up. We had to get on our hands and knees and crawl a couple of times. We had heavy weapons, and two men had heavy flamethrowers on their backs. We were all scared. One of the flame-throwing Marines was Chuck Lindbergh. Even he was braced for instant bloodshed. "We thought it would be a slaughterhouse up on Suribachi," he later said. "I still don't understand why we were not attacked." As the Marines climbed, they beheld Iwo Jima for the first time from the perspective of the Japanese. Spreading below them in panorama were the landing beaches and the armada at anchor in the ocean. The narrow neck they had secured at such cost, the enemy airstrip, and the rising terrain of the main bulk to the north, and the small figures that were their comrades gazing back up at them. How close, how intimate, how eerily serene it all must have looked to them. About two-thirds of the way up, Lieutenant Schreier sent out flankers on either side of the main unit for cover. "We were tense," said Robert Leader, thinking the enemy would suddenly jump out or one of us would step on a mine, but it was completely quiet. Not a shot was fired. It took us about 40 minutes to get to the top. Sergeant Lowry documented the ascent with his cumbersome camera. At one point he asked a Marine to unfold the flag so he could get a photo of it being carried up. The patrol clawed its way to the rim of the crater at about 10 a.m. Looking down into the bowl, the boys of the patrol saw devastation. Japanese anti-aircraft guns fused together by the heat of American bombing. Twisted metal, pulverized rock. Robert Leader could not suppress a smile of glee as he spotted two large drop tanks, jettisoned fuel tanks from Navy planes. "I got a chuckle thinking of the Japanese watching those tanks come down," he said. Leader's next impulse probably expressed the attitude of every young Marine who would face the mountain. I said to Leo Rozek, "Gee, I have to pee." Rozek said, "Great idea." So we both peed down the hill. I said, "I proclaim this volcano property of the United States of America." The spit and polish Hank Hansen took this in and was indignant. "Knock that off! Who do you think you are?" Leader had a ready answer. "I'm an American citizen." Hansen changed the subject. He relayed a request by Colonel Liversedge that Leader, as the platoon's unofficial artist, make sketches of everything around him. Leader set to work. Then Boots Thomas came up with an order of his own. "See if you can find a pole to put the flag on." Leader set aside his sketch pad. He'd bound his drawings together with surgical tape supplied by Doc, and he and Rozek scoured the rubble at their feet. The Japanese had constructed a catch system for rainwater on the crater's surface, and fragments of pipe lay scattered about. Rozek, rummaging in the mud, found a fragment of usable length. He and Leader lugged it upright. The two discovered a bullet hole in the pipe. The rope could be threaded through that. They manhandled the pole, as Leader put it, up to where Thomas was waiting. Then, knowing that this was an important moment that would be photographed, the patrol's brass took over. Lieutenant Schreier, Platoon Sergeant Thomas, Sergeant Hansen, and Corporal Lindbergh converged on the pole. They shook the folded flag out and tied it in place. Lou Lowry documented the proceedings with a steady succession of camera shots. He moved in close, suggested poses, cajoled the boys into self-conscious grins with his patter. Louis Charlo joined the four. At 10:20 a.m., they thrust the pole upright in the gusty wind, the first foreign flag ever to fly over Japanese soil. Lowry, wanting added drama for his shot, motioned to Jim Michaels, who crouched dramatically in the foreground with his carbine. Then a glitch. Lowry shouted, "Wait a minute," to the posing Marines. He'd run out of film and needed a second to reload. Lindbergh scowled and grunted at him to hurry it up. Men holding flags were easy targets. With a fresh roll of film in his camera, Lowry called for a final posed shot. Hansen, Thomas, and Schreier gripping the flagpole as they stiffly circled it, Lindbergh and Charlo watching them from a couple of paces off. Michaels adding drama in the foreground with the gun. As Lowry clicked this exposure, an amazing cacophony arose from the island below and from the ships offshore. Thousands of Marine and Navy personnel had been watching the patrol as they climbed to the volcano's rim. When the small swatch of color fluttered, Iwo Jima was transformed for a few moments into Times Square on New Year's Eve. Infantrymen cheered, whistled, and waved their helmets. Ships offshore opened up their deep, honking whistles. Here was the symbol of an impossible dream fulfilled. Here was the manifestation of Suribachi's conquest. Here was the first invader's flag ever planted in four millennia on the territorial soil of Japan. Chuck Lindbergh, a man not much given to sentiment, would remember it as a big wave of noise washing over them. It gave him a happy chill, the likes of which he'd never experienced before or since. Robert McElDowney of Roanoke, Illinois, had watched the patrol's ascent from the landing beach. Now he joined the wild hooting and yelling as he savored the crowning moment. "It was a thrill," he said. "When they put that flag up, I'll never forget. The entire island erupted with cheers. It sent a chill up and down my spine." Max Heffley watched too, through his binoculars. "It felt great," he said. "When the flag went up, there was a lot of noise all over the island." Many of the young Marines, in their giddiness, assumed that the Battle of Iwo Jima was over. In this, they were drastically mistaken. Robert Leader was one combatant who did not make this assumption. Amid the jubilation, he experienced a chill of a darker sort than Lindbergh's or McElDowney's. "When I saw the flag, I thought it was a bad idea for us up there," he remembered. "It was like sitting in the middle of a bullseye." Leaders' misgivings quickly proved prophetic. Just moments after the Stars and Stripes went up, Hot Rocks' summit got hot again. The first Japanese emerged from his tunnel with his back to the Marines. Harold Keller spotted him at once and fired his rifle 3 times from the hip. The fallen figure was yanked back into the hole from where he'd come. Another sniper immediately popped up and aimed his rifle at the Marines. Chick Robeson gunned him down. Next was a maddened Japanese officer who leaped into view with a broken sword. An alert Marine dropped him. Now the crater briefly came alive with ordnance. The serpent was not completely dead after all. Hand grenades started to arc out of several enemy caves. The Marines took cover and began hurling grenades of their own. Photographer Lou Lowry was standing near the flag when a Japanese soldier stuck his head out of a cave and lobbed a grenade. Lowry dove over the volcano's rim and rolled and slid about 40 feet down the steep, jagged side before he could break his fall. He suffered several cuts to his flesh but was not seriously injured. His camera was broken, but his film was safe. Lowry decided it was time to head back down to find another camera. The firefight lasted several minutes, and no American casualties were taken. And then the invisible enemy was silent once again. After things had settled down, some of the young Marines grew fascinated with the view down below. Donald Howell found a working pair of large artillery field glasses amazingly intact in the rubble. He propped them up on their tripod, gazed through them, and was startled by what he could see. "They gave you an amazing view of the beaches," he recalled. "They, the Japanese, could see our every move." When 18-year-old James Buchanan had his turn, the war fell away for a moment, and he was taken with boyish wonder. "I looked through them and could see all of Iwo. It was beautiful." For others, the morning exacted grimmer duties. Chuck Lindbergh remembered that he and his comrades spent the ensuing hours securing the mountain. "We used the flamethrowers or demolition charges for the caves we couldn't walk into, and we walked into whatever caves we could. We burned them out. We didn't know what side the Japanese would be coming up from, so we had to work fast." Only later would the Marines comprehend just how much danger still festered inside Suribachi on the morning of February 23rd. Rummaging through an open cave for souvenirs a few days afterward, Lindbergh and Chick Robeson uncovered a sickening sight: the bodies of at least 150 Japanese freshly dead. They had died of self-inflicted wounds. "The stench was so foul that we had to put on gas masks," Robeson recalled. "We went in with a small flashlight and found it to be a large cave in two parts. Dead Japanese lay all about, so thick we had to tread on some. Many had died by holding grenades to their stomachs." "Why these Japanese hadn't tried to bolt from the cave and overwhelm the flag-raising patrol is a mystery," Robeson continued. "They had our men outnumbered 4-1. What made the situation even more unaccountable was that there were other occupied caves on the summit. We'll never know the number of Japanese who could have hurled themselves against our patrol, but there were surely enough to have killed every man in it." There is one persuasive explanation for those self-annihilated soldiers, and it speaks to the corruption of Bushido that was wrought by Japan's malignant military regime. A traditional samurai might expect to die in combat and be honored for it. He might kill himself to atone for a moral mistake or a failure of courage. But suicide as an expression of ultimate sacrifice for one's country was not a traditional samurai value. This was a construct of a deranged military establishment cynically bent on extracting the maximum utility from its isengorin. While the 3rd Platoon was taking control of Suribachi's summit, other things were going on down below. The Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal, had decided the previous night that he wanted to go ashore and witness the final stage of the fight for the mountain. Now, under a stern commitment to take orders from Howland Mad Smith, the secretary was churning ashore in the company of the blunt, earthy general. Their boat touched the beach just after the flag went up, and the mood among the high command turned jubilant. Gazing upward at the red, white, and blue speck, Forrestal remarked to Smith, "Holland, the raising of that flag on Suribachi means a Marine Corps for the next 500 years." Forrestal was so taken with the fervor of the moment that he decided he wanted the Suribachi flag as a souvenir. The news of this wish did not sit well with Chandler Johnson, whose temperament was every bit as fiery as Howlin' Mad's. "The hell with that!" the colonel spat when that message reached him. The flag belonged to the battalion, as far as Johnson was concerned. He decided to secure it as soon as possible and dispatched his assistant operations officer, Lieutenant Ted Tuttle, to the beach to scare up a replacement flag. As an afterthought, Johnson called after Tuttle, "And make it a bigger one!" At about this same time, a short, nearsighted, mustachioed wire service photographer named Joe Rosenthal was struggling through a bad morning indeed. Rosenthal, covering the invasion for the Associated Press, had landed on Iwu at around noon on D-Day and had risked his life to get stirring action shots through the days of combat that followed. But on the morning of February 23rd, nothing seemed to go right for him. He slipped on a wet ladder and fell into the ocean between the command ship and a landing craft. Fished out, he unzipped his camera, a bulky and durable speed graphic, from its waterproof bag and clicked off a shot of Forrestal and Smith looking resolutely toward the beach. As he was approaching Iwo Jima in an LCT in the company of Bill Hipple, a magazine correspondent, the bosun told Rosenthal he had just heard on his radio that a patrol was climbing Suribachi. "The hell you say," Hipple said. "That's what I heard," the sailor said. Hipple and Rosenthal headed toward the mountain, being careful to avoid marked mines, until they reached the command post of the 28th Regiment. There they encountered two Marines who were also combat photographers, Private Bob Campbell, who worked with a still camera, and Sergeant Bill Ganost, who had a movie camera loaded with color film. "I think we'll be too late for the flag raising," Ganost remarked. But Rosenthal had come too far to turn back. "I'd still like to go up," he said, and talked Campbell and Ganost, who were armed, into making the ascent with him. The three men shouldered their cameras and hit the steep trail. While Lieutenant Tuttle was off searching for a replacement flag, Chandler Johnson decided that Lieutenant Schreier up on the mountain could use a wired connection with the base for his field telephone, whose battery signal was growing weak. He rang up Dave Severance at Easy Company and ordered a detail to reel out a phone wire. The 2nd Platoon had just trooped in from its probe around the mountain's base. Severance ordered Mike, Harlan, Ira, and Franklin to the battalion command post to tie in a telephone wire that the fire team would then unreel up the mountain. Strank said simply, "Let's go." The boys were tired, but nobody asked the young sergeant where they were going. Nobody complained. As Ira later wrote, "We were certainly uneasy." The captain also dispatched his runner, 19-year-old Rene Gagnon, to the command post for fresh SCR-300 batteries for Schreier. They reached Colonel Johnson's field headquarters just as Lieutenant Tuttle hurried into view. He was carrying an American flag that he had obtained from LST-779 on the beach. As it happened, this flag, which at 96 by 56 inches was a good deal larger than the one now planted on the mountain, had been found in a salvage yard at Pearl Harbor, rescued from a sinking ship on that date which will live in infamy. Tuttle handed the flag to Chandler Johnson, who in turn gave it to Rene to put inside his field pack. "When you get to the top," the colonel told Mike, "you tell Schreier to put this flag up, and I want him to save the small flag for me." With their cargo of telephone wire, batteries, and American flag, the five boys set off up the mountain, unreeling the wire as they climbed. Doc had remained atop the mountain. They reached the rim around noon. Mike reported to Lieutenant Schreier and explained the delivery of wire and batteries and Johnson's desire to preserve the first flag. As Rene handed Mike the replacement flag, the sergeant decided an explanation was in order. "Colonel Johnson wants this big flag run up high," he told the lieutenant, "so every son of a bitch on this whole cruddy island can see it." Mike directed Ira and Franklin to look for a length of pipe. He and Harlan started clearing a spot for planting the pole, and Harlan began stacking stones. On his descent from the crater, Lowry encountered Joe Rosenthal, Bill Ganost, and Bob Campbell picking their way upward. Lowry told the group that he'd photograph the flag raising. The three photographers considered turning around and heading back, but Lowry had a different idea. "You should go on up there," he said. "There's a hell of a good view of the harbor." The three photographers trudged on. A good view of a different sort greeted Rosenthal when he reached the summit, a little after noon. The American flag in close-up snapping in the strong breeze. I tell you, I still get this feeling of a patriotic jolt when I recall seeing our flag flying up there, he told an interviewer some years later. Then Rosenthal spotted another interesting sight toward the far side of the crater, a couple of Marines hauling an iron pole toward another Marine who was holding a second American flag neatly folded. Rosenthal's fingers instinctively went to his speed graphic. Maybe he would get a flag-raising photograph after all. The pole that Ira and Franklin were dragging was a length of drainage pipe that weighed more than 100 pounds. As they approached the site, Lieutenant Schreier suggested that Mike's team do the job. The lieutenant wanted the replacement flag raised simultaneously with the lowering of the first one. Mike attached the flag to the pole. Schreier rounded up some Marines to lower the first pole and then stood between the two clusters of flag groups, directing them. The three photographers milled about some distance away near the volcano's outer rim. Each of the three looked for a good vantage point. Campbell walked away and moved into position a short distance down the hillside, almost directly below the first flag, so that he could shoot upward at it as the Marines took it down. Gnost, almost shoulder to shoulder with Rosenthal, about 30 yards from the second flag, had a few feet of color film left in his camera and decided to wait for the right moment to use them. The 5'5" Rosenthal had put down his speed graphic and was bent over, piling up stones and a sandbag to stand on and improve his shooting angle. His camera was set at a speed of 1/400th of a second, with the f-stop between 8 and 16. No one else on the summit paid much attention to what was going on. The action had all the significance of a new football being tossed into a game in progress. It all happened in seconds. Gnost's movie camera recorded it all. In the solitude of my living room, I have watched those few seconds again and again in slow motion. Here is how it unfolded. Harlan braced himself above the target spot in the rubble-strewn ground, ready to receive the base of the pole. Mike, at the other end, in charge, guided it toward him, the pipe over his right shoulder. Mike held a large flag wrapped around the pole to keep it from fluttering in the strong wind until the pole was planted. Mike and his four squad members circled closer to the pole. They raised their feet high with each step to get clear of the debris. It looked as if they were walking in deep snow. Ira walked toward the pole, facing Mike, his back to Gnost's camera frame. He said something to Mike that was lost in the strong wind. Ira was wearing his Indian-style blanket stuffed through his military belt on his rump. Mike saw Doc Bradley walking past with a load of bandages in his arms and asked him to come and help. Doc dropped the bandages and moved to the pole, directly between Mike and Harlan. Franklin walked to the pole from the foreground of Gnost's camera frame. Rene approached the group from behind to the right, his rifle slung over his shoulder. He stood behind my father, who was in front of the pole in the movie frame. The boys converged in a cluster behind Harlan, who bent low at the base. Doc gripped the pole in the cluster's center. Rosenthal spotted the movement and grabbed his camera. Gnost, about 3 feet from Rosenthal, asked, "I'm not in your way, am I, Joe?" "Oh, no," Rosenthal answered. As he later remembered, I turned from him, and out of the corner of my eye, I said, "Hey, Bill, there it goes." He swung his camera and clicked off a frame. In that same instant, the flagpole rose upward in a quick arc. The banner, released from Mike's grip, fluttered out in the strong wind. Rosenthal remembers, "By being polite to each other, we both damn near missed the scene. I swung my camera around and held it until I could guess that this was the peak of the action and shot. And then it was over. The flag was up." Campbell had gotten the shot he was after, the first flag going down in the foreground of his frame and the second one going up off in the distance. Gnost had gotten the footage he wanted, a routine, spontaneous color sequence of the replacement flag raising. Only Joe Rosenthal was unsure. The AP man didn't even have a chance to glimpse the image in his viewfinder. Of course, he later said, "I couldn't positively say I had the picture. It's something like shooting a football play. You don't brag about it until it's developed." He'd captured 1/400th of a second out of 4 seconds of fluid motion. He had no idea whether he'd gotten a blur, a shot of the sky, or a passable photograph. The six continued to struggle with the heavy pole in the whipping wind. The pole was fully upright. Harlan raised his hands up the pole and gripped it, baseball bat style, using his weight to force it into the ground. Ira did the same. Then Franklin added his heft. Mike anchored things. Within a few more seconds, the flagpole was freestanding, the cloth snapping and cracking in the wind. After a moment, Franklin and some of the others began looking for rocks to add support. Doc offered ropes he'd brought along to tie casualties to stretchers, and they secured the pole. No one paid attention. It was just a replacement flag. The important flag, the first one raised that day, was brought down the mountain and presented to Colonel Johnson, who stored it in the battalion safe. It bore too much historic value for the battalion to be left unguarded atop Suribachi. The replacement flag flew for 3 weeks, eventually chewed up by the strong winds. A few moments after the raising, Joe Rosenthal did what Lowry had done a couple of hours before him. He called several Marines over to cluster around the pole for a standard posed gung-ho shot. Lieutenant Schreier helped gather a crowd of boys for this photograph. Mike, Ira, Doc, Franklin, and 14 other Marines posed proudly beneath the flag, waving their arms, rifles, and helmets. Ira Hayes is smiling in this shot, his face creased with a wide, happy grin. He is the only seated figure among the 18. Mike is standing next to Lieutenant Schreier. His lips are puckered as if he is yelling a joyous hoo-ah. Franklin and Doc are behind Mike, one peering over each of his broad shoulders. Franklin has a triumphant smile and is thrusting his carbine in the air. Doc Bradley would later say, "We were happy, and in this shot he looks it. He has a big smile as he waves his helmet with his right hand." Joe Rosenthal was satisfied with this posed shot. He felt certain that with all these smiling young boys facing the camera and the landing beaches visible below, he had a photograph that would make the papers back home. But the AP photographer would have to wait several days before he knew. That night, his film was flown to Guam for developing. If there were any good shots, they would be transmitted by radio signal to New York. Several months later, the 2nd Battalion filed its action report for its role in the Battle of Iwo Jima. In describing the events of February 23rd, the report covered the reconnaissance patrol of the early morning. It covered Easy Company's 15-man patrol around the southern tip of the island, the 2nd Platoon. It covered Lieutenant Schreier's expedition up Suribachi with the 40-man patrol from Easy and the planting of the first American flag at 10:20 a.m., It mentioned the blowing up of caves, the recovery of the Japanese binoculars, the sporadic resistance by fleeing Japanese. The action report made no mention of a second flag raising. It was, after all, only a replacement flag.